Blog Talk Radio.
One, two, one, two. I can't hear my, what's going on here. I can't hear myself. One, two. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I seem to be on the air, but I didn't hear my theme song. Let's see if I hear the theme song. I don't know what's going on here with the studio. Nothing seems to be coming up. Okay, let's try this one. I don't know if I'm on the air, and if I am on the air, well, let's see. It says I am on the air, so... Well, I guess I'm on the air now. Can't tell because there must be a problem with Skype because I didn't play that. This is the last word, and I am Michael Lawson, and Thomas Fortenberry should be calling in very shortly. We need to find out whether or not I am on the air, and it looks like I am. So... we got a lot to talk about today. This is, I said, as the last word. I don't know what happened with our theme song. That was the theme song from The Untouchables. You remember The Untouchables? Now, wait a minute. Some of you might not remember the original Untouchables. The original Untouchables came on in the late 50s, 58, I believe. And Robert Stack was in that. They had all the major... big boys that became major movie stars in that show. Later on, they appeared. Robert Stack, of course, he was a major star anyway. But Neville Brand, he played Al Capone. Neville Brand always played a bad guy. And let's see, we got Thomas on the air. Thomas, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, you know, the show started. The theme song, I don't know if it started because I could not get my voice up. And I went to, I tried to go to the audio clips here on the studio, and I saw that the Untouchables theme song was playing. Couldn't hear it. And then I tried to get on with Skype, and I couldn't get on with Skype. And then all of a sudden it popped up. But the music had stopped playing on my studio, but it was still playing. So I don't know if it was a delay
I had some trouble connecting as well.
Oh, you did?
So it may just be, I called in four times and it dumped it after about 30 seconds or a minute. It would just disconnect. So I don't know. Must be having some issues there.
Must be, because I don't know if it's, I think this is down. Skype is broadcasting from Georgia, Atlanta, somewhere. Anyway, I want to just play a few seconds of this theme song. I want you to give us the mood here.
The mood.
Now, you remember? You remember that theme song?
Oh, yeah.
The Untouchable. It came on at a very odd time. It came on at 9:30. And I think it was either Tuesday or Thursday night. It's very odd. And that show was great. That was one of the shows I was permitted to stay up and watch.
Right.
And
I remember watching it with my parents too. They loved my dad, you know, he loved all gangster, you know, also westerns, but that was his thing. He loved gangsters and all the gangster movies and all the gangster shows, and we used to watch Untouchables and Dragnet and, you know, any of that type stuff. So.
Oh yeah. That was good. Yeah, the Dragnet was on. Well, Dragnet was on a little bit before that, but the what was the other one that was on Dragnet? And M Squad with Lee Marvin.
Oh yeah,
you remember that?
Yeah.
M Squad with Lee
Marvin. Oh, Lee Marvin. Oh yeah.
As a matter of fact,
I haven't thought about Lee in a few years.
I'll give you a little taste of Lee Marvin here, but M Squad with Lee Marvin was one of the, I mean, that was the first show that used jazz music to get people involved. Let's listen to a little bit of M Squad. Now, I used to use it as my theme, so I still love it. I might go back to that. But that was the first of Quincy Jones. Count Basie, I should say. That was Count Basie.
Count Basie.
And Count Basie. And then along came Peter Gunn. Let's do a little bit of him.
Oh, Peter Gunn's got that iconic sound. Woo! Love that tune.
That was Henry Mancini that did that.
Right. That's one of the most famous theme songs ever.
Oh, yeah. And then you had...
Hey, was that that did that? Was that Blake Edwards or somebody like that?
They used to do that show. No. That was Henry Mancini. Henry Mancini also wrote...
That's what I'm directing.
The Pink Panther. He did the Pink Panther also.
Right, but wasn't that
Blake Edwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Blake Edwards wrote the Pink Panther, but Henry Mancini did the music.
Right, yeah. See, I love those old, I mean, the jazz. And, you know, remembering also when he used to always have the episodes, he always hung out in the jazz bars, and his girlfriend worked there.
There was one club, and he hung out with. And Mother was the name of the owner of the club.
Mother, that's right.
Mother.
Hello, Mother. Yeah, oh man, that's so good.
And all the gangsters in town used to, they couldn't get him because he was so tough and everything. Yep. They would go after mother, go after his girlfriend, the singer. She was the singer.
Yep.
In the little bar. And well, it was a club, little club. And the police lieutenant used to be his best friend. They used to sit down there and drink.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was Craig Stevens that played Peter Gunn. And
Craig
he was
Stevens.
Tall, very
okay.
tall guy. He was about 6'4", 6'3". And,
yeah, I mean, that's what you had on those shows. You had no misunderstanding that he was a tough guy, you know.
Oh, yeah,
he dominated
yeah,
those shows.
Oh, yeah. But you see, and that's when they started with M Squad, with Lee Marvin. He dressed sharp, and he was from Chicago, M Squad.
Right.
That was his beat, was Chicago. He said, this is my city, Chicago. And I got to get that for next week and play that sequence. But
well, it's one thing that I think that these new shows that, you know, are on all these new cop shows, you got, you know, 55 versions of CSI or whatever. But anyway, these new shows, they kind of lack, they're all so generic, they could be anywhere, even though they claim to be each city, you know. And they lack that character that these shows had with the music and the style.
Well, you know why?
And I wish they would go back to that.
See, they can't do that, see, because that theme, these themes were dedicated to those particular heroes and characters, protagonists of the show. But in
right.
these shows we have today, you got 8 and 9 characters in it.
Yeah, it's all
so,
just,
so,
that's
so,
why
so
I said they're so wooden. Like, I can't ever even keep up with, you know, you watch one or the other, and it's the same
right.
cast.
It's a collage.
I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah, it's a collage of characters now. It's no longer one guy against everybody
right.
else. It's a collaborative effort now.
Yeah,
you
now
know?
It's all a team.
Yeah, now you're
well,
right.
I'll tell you, there is one guy who dominates all of these clone team shows of cops, and that's
yeah.
Gorin. I think Gorin on Law & Order CI. He's one of the strongest characters in modern shows.
Well, yeah, well, you see...
Because he is just as quirky and unique as they come, you know?
Well, you see, I never watched the show, but the thing
oh, you
never
watched that?
I never watched Gorin. I started watching it after it was off, and I liked him.
Right.
You know who I liked? I liked that he took his place. I like, what's the name, who took his place? What's the tall, thin guy?
Oh, the real strange dude?
The one that
the
was
fly.
In, the fly, the one
he's
who was the in
fly.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
I like
Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum. I like his character better than like the other guy. I loved him.
Well, yeah, I didn't like him as much just because he wasn't as powerful, but I liked his character. He was very distinct, very unique.
That's right.
And he liked jazz. He liked to play. And I thought
that was a nice return
to the old style.
I like it. But you see, again, being individual in these shows, it's always a collaborative effort. They never
right.
do anything on their own. Because they get it, they fingerprint, and, you know, they
and then they're going to have the lab technicians, and then they're going to have
right.
the computer technicians, and then they're going
right,
to have the
right.
forensic, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, Peter Gunn, the hardball detectives, the Mike Hammers, the famous characters from Raymond Chandler detectives.
Yeah.
I mean, all
or,
these guys,
or the Raymond Burr when he was a lawyer,
Burr,
tough lawyer.
The lawyer, but again, he started drifting into. He had his secretary got involved, and he also had his private detective that helped him out. But
right.
the Peter Gunn I need to get the theme song for Richard Diamond, private detective.
Mm-hmm.
That well, I love that. Now, see, here's another thing: these private detectives, it started with Lee Marvin dressing sharp. And wearing that distinctive hat. Because I remember getting and wearing a hat just like him when I was in high school. And
right.
then, you know, that hat, that he had a distinctive hat. And then, you know, he was also a big guy, too. He's like 6'3". So he dressed sharp, too. But then Peter Gunn, with the cut hair, the perfect
yep.
clothes, and the jazz, that, so they leaned to this guy who loved to dress, who loved to drink, He loved women, okay? Then he went to the Richard Diamond. And how Richard Diamond started was, it started with a phone call from his answering service, and you never saw her. You only saw her legs. And you know who that was?
Who?
You know, huh? Oh, come on. You got to guess. Mary Tyler Moore.
Are you serious?
That was Mary Tyler Moore's leg. Yes, that was Mary Tyler Moore's leg. Yes.
Wow.
So you only saw, and she said, yes, Mr. Diamond.
And she always said, Mr. Grant, phone.
No, yes, no, no, yeah, right. Same Mr. Grant, right. But he would call her. That was the only other person that you saw that was connected with him as an extension.
Right.
As a telephone operator. And Richard Diamond created the high, David Jansen, in his show, I'll tell you how fashion to go. He created what they call the high boy collar of a shirt. That was the very high shirt. It was like 3 inches high, the collar. And
right.
I remember buying them. That was the style back then. I wore them. Well, see, I dressed when I went to high school. See, today they don't dress. I never wore sneakers. The only time I wore sneakers was when I was playing ball. But we...
Yeah, that's what they used to be, athletic shoes, not everyday shoes.
That's right. That's what they used to be. And I never wore sneakers. I always wore shoes. We had a black pair of shoes, we had a brown pair of shoes. We even had three pair of shoes, my brother, where we would change. Because we had to wear shoes. We had school shoes, too, because we had to wear black, because we had to wear uniforms in the Catholic school. But I remember when I got to high school, I would wear the high boy collar. I mean, that was fabulous. And he started wearing the shirts. He had the distinctive. So they set trends, fashion trends, TV characters, but they were loners. They were the Raymond Chandler characters. They were the Humphrey Bogart characters. They were the smoking, hard-fighting, crime-solving characters that didn't need any police to help them. They didn't need a crime.
Yeah, half the time they were working against the police. Under suspicion or something.
Right. They did not have to have the police do anything. And here's another little music intro from let's see, you guess who this is. Who was that? That name of that music was...
Yeah, I know exactly who that character always played that music. You know who it was? Joe Cool, Snoopy. That was the music he always played when he was Joe Cool.
That's right. That was Killer Joe by Quincy Jones. But these characters that these guys played, what's his name? Who's my character from... Raymond Chandler. It was who's the guy that Humphrey Bogart played? Maltese Falcon.
Oh, the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, that was. My mind is completely blank.
You had what was his name? Was the main? You talking about the main character?
Yeah, the name
or
of the
Guttman?
Character was. No, Guttman was the bad guy.
Yeah, Guttman is who he's against, but I'm saying I can't think of his name.
Yeah, that was, golly, what the heck is his name? I can't think of his name. The name of the character. What is the name of the character?
I'd have to go upstairs and get Maltese Falcon off my bookshelf to find out.
Well, this was Dashiell Hammett that did the Maltese Falcon. Sam Spade.
Yeah, that's what I said. I could look up the actual book. Yeah.
Yeah, that Sam Spade. And that was Dashiell Hammett that did that. But Raymond Chandler did the other one. He did the we'll just wait a minute here. Now let's look this up. Raymond Chandler. That's the one. Raymond Chandler did his character was the guy in The Big Sleep. That was Raymond Chandler too, and that was Humphrey Bogart. But Raymond Chandler's character is Philip Marlowe. Philip Marlowe. So the thing is,
Marlowe, Private Eye.
That these are the lone characters where they could write specific music for them.
Right.
Today, you can't write a theme song. You have a theme song for an entire show. But you could identify person. In the old days, this music actually fit.
Yeah, because it had an attitude.
Right, it had an attitude, right. And that character had the same attitude.
Right.
Lee Marvin.
Well,
a lot of times
these days, they also just will use a pop song instead of an actual soundtrack. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, in Lee Marvin now, when the first came out, the thing you see they're playing the music, and then all of a sudden, Lee Marvin would come into the frame with his hand in the pocket and say, "This is my city." And he would just have an attitude. He'd stand there with an attitude, with his cigarette, smoke on it, and throw it down, and then walk off. And I forgot what he said. "This is my city, and I don't allow this and that," or something he said. But and the music reflected his attitude, the way he even walked. Okay, now if you go to Peter Gunn's theme song, Henny Mancini, is cool, calm, and he never got excited when he talked to anybody. And he always talked low, very slow and low, and he talked to his girlfriend, and he would talk low and slow, and it would always be worry about, that's how what am I going to do about this? And he said, don't worry. Lois was her name. Lois said, don't worry about it. But Lee Marvin's character, no. We hit them hard. We knock them down. And this is my character. These guys ain't doing jack. Then you got Richard Diamond. The David Jenkins character, he was cool, like Peter Gunn, but not the. What he did was his character was cool too, and he would always have Peter Gunn, but would have a snarky attitude to it, like,
right.
You're not kidding me. I know what you're talking about. And he said, "Who do you think you talked to?" I mean, he was always the best dressed guy in every single scene. Even when he was beat up, he was dressed better than the guys in the scene with him.
Right.
And he always wore a hat all the time. 90% of the time, he wore a suit, different suit every scene, and that high boy collar shirt, which I don't see much anymore. Who wears a high boy collar shirt? That's the general manager of the Miami Heat, my guy. He still wears it. But otherwise,
I saw anybody with an extensive collar was Telly Savalas. unbuttoned and open all the way to his shoulders.
the thing is that nobody does that anymore because everything is so daggone,
Everything is casual.
Yeah, everything is casual.
Hey, I mean, half the time when I go out now to stores, you see people walking around in pajamas and stuff out in public, man.
Oh, yeah.
It's
please,
crazy.
Are you kidding me? I went to the food line the other day, and this person was in her pajama bottoms with her slippers.
Yep. I see that all the time. People just shuffling along.
Give me a break. There is no way we could be like that. We could be like that. There is no way.
Well, I remember one time. You know, staying with my grandmother, man, I used to get up, I'd come to the breakfast table, she'd send me back to my room and be furious if I came out in my pajamas.
Oh, absolutely.
She told me, you do not leave your bedroom unless you're dressed. You know, people do not do that. She scolded me, man. Whew.
Oh, I'm telling you, they said that does not happen. But
she said, those are your bed clothes. Those aren't public clothes.
Right. No, I mean, it's not. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, absolutely right. We did not do that. The thing is that I remember of course we had a dress every day in a uniform going to school. We had a blue, navy blue pants, black shoes, navy blue tie, navy blue shirt, and a white shirt. And it had the insignia. We had a blue sweater to wear in the wintertime that had the insignia, and we had a short sleeve shirt that had the insignia on it. So we had dressed that way. You had to have shoes, and your shoes had to be shined. You couldn't come to school with your shoes scuffed or anything like that. You had to be dressed.
Right.
And the girls also wore. I'm trying to think if they wore blue or purple. It wasn't purple. Maybe it was lavender. I can't remember what the girls wore. But anyway, and no pants. The girls didn't wear no pants.
Mm-mm.
You kidding me? I don't even know when that started. But so I just got in the habit of dressing. And then I was going out with my mother all the time. She was always in the theater district and whatnot because she was an agent. But I
so you
would
go have
to school.
A good appearance.
Right. Right. So when I went to school, high school, I carried that with me. And I even, no, not many, I don't know, hardly any. There was a few kids that wore suits to school. But I wore to, and we went to, I went to a public high school. We were dressed. We were one of the elite high schools there, so our dress was very important. And we dressed I don't remember ever wearing a shirt. Oh, well, my first year without a tie. Short sleeve shirt, long sleeve shirt.
Right.
And a sweater. Back then it was those, what were those sweaters? Cardigans.
I like that.
Everybody wore
cardigans.
Back then. Cardigans sweater.
Yeah.
And that's what we wore. But it has changed so much today. I mean, how was that?
You know, I was surprised. Even like, you know, our schools, public schools, you know, you can wear jeans and everything else. It was just all whatever. The only restrictions they had were, you know, don't come in like shorts or you know, no shirt or something like that, you know. But other than that, you can just show up, you know. So last time I saw a dress in school, now, you know, some of the schools here, my kids are in, have uniforms nowadays. They've reinstated that, trying to get back to some kind of order, which is nice. But the only time that I've seen it as a cultural thing, and I really liked it, was when I went to University of London over there. All the schools there, even if this was college level, but all the schools there required you to dress formally for class. So I had to wear, you know, button-down shirts, tie, you know, slacks, the whole thing. And when you went into class, you were always dressed, and they had that policy, like when the teacher came in, you all had to stand, you know, when they started making sure you sit down, all that. And then when they left, you had to stand again, things like that, just very formal. But it totally transforms the atmosphere of the classroom.
When you have to do something to get something done, it changes how you operate. And you have to dress I mean, I've
well, if you dress well and you treat people with respect, it just kind of feeds into the whole atmosphere. You know, everybody had respect. You had respect for learning, respect for the teachers, respect for the whole process.
Well, it's just like, you know, Phil Jackson, well, Pat Riley is the one I'm talking about, who still wears the highball collars. And Pat Riley was always immaculately dressed. He still is immaculately. He's the president, not general manager of Miami Heat. But anyway, I loved him when he was with the Lakers. Loved him. I wish the Knicks would have got him. But anyway, but the thing is that I remember going to church. Never, ever, ever, ever do I ever remember wearing sneakers to church growing up. Never. I don't remember that. I remember that you had to be dressed to go to church. And I would be dressed. I wore a suit to church. Or I well, because I went to my church where I went to school, so or I would wear my uniform sweater if it was in the wintertime. I mean, it would but take coat off the church and whatnot, and it wasn't too crowded. But the thing is that I remember we were here, we just moved here maybe a couple of years, and we were going to see a Nancy Wilson concert at the Bojangles Arena. And it said on the ticket, the tickets were like $60, I believe. And it was an evening with Nancy Wilson. And the dress was black tie. Was not black tie. It was after six.
Mm-hmm.
I dressed up in a black suit and tie. My wife, she wore a black dress. It was wasn't a cocktail. It was a after six dress. So we were dressed semi formal. I go there. There are some people who look like they just got out of working at Walmart.
Right.
I could not believe that. I could, but because after the concert, they chose people to come and have a cocktail there. They chose them. They didn't. You didn't sign in for it. I mean, none of those people got chosen.
Well,
why
of course
would you
not.
Somebody look like? I don't understand that.
Rolled up in a truck with flip-flops and shorts or something.
And the thing is that, and I don't know if this is a regional thing or whatnot, but I go to things today that are marked formal, and people come in with sports shirts on.
Right.
I don't understand that. What is the attitude? But that was, I've never seen that in New York City. Never seen that. If it says after sports, you ain't going there with no sneakers and sports shirts. Is that just something that's a... That's something that's
I think that
in
all,
the South?
Well, I don't think it's the South per se. I think it's all of American culture that has gotten very, 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 very lax.
Yeah,
as they just have.
I just don't understand, you know, and...
Because it's just like, you know, you're thinking about work. You know, nowadays they always have those, you know, informal days at work where you can, you know, wear a T-shirt or whatever, you know, that type of stuff. And they used to, that was just strictly forbidden, you know.
But why is that? Why do you want
to
have...
Because we're all going to end up on those couches like the big jelly in outer space. You remember Wally?
Yes.
The future of the human race. We'll just be sitting around slurping big slurps with float-around chairs. Who needs to get dressed, Mike? Come on, you have to get up. I got a remote control.
You know, I was talking to my neighbor across the way, across the street. Eddie Giel is his name, German. He's a good guy, him and his wife. And he said, you know, he said, he was asking if my wife was retiring. And I said, well, she might be, but, you know, not just yet. So what happened was that, how do I do this now? What did I do here? I lost my big one. Oh, God, let me go back in here.
Phone and I hit the wrong button. I lost
good,
my lost
good,
my
good story, Mike. Good story, Mike.
Anyway, so what happened was, I go and so we were talking, and he says to me, he's over visiting his relatives in Germany, and he said that every one of his relatives, the same age as him, is retired. Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Every last one is retired.
Right.
And he says, because they asked me if I was retired. They're all the same age as me. He's 70, 74, something like that. I said, so what is that all about? I mean, I don't understand. Why are you complaining about that? He says, I say, well, I shouldn't be working. I said, well, hey, you got to do what you got to do. And why do I have, I hit the button again. And lost, oh, there it is.
Nations have that social net like that, though.
Well, here's the thing. He said that both his brothers worked for, Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them. Another one worked for Jaguar. So they all have fabulous pensions.
Right.
He says they do not have to go out and get another job. They can live on what they got.
Right.
He said buying the car over there in Germany costs less than buying a car here. And
right.
He said that the people here do not get paid jack. He said a worker in Detroit building a car gets one half what the worker does in Germany.
Exactly.
One half. He
said, been on this for a long time, though. They have a very, look.
Entire world.
They have, their entire societies are there. They are socially engineered to support people and help people out because that's the role of society.
Oh, wait a minute.
Government.
Oh, wait, are you talking about socialism? Are you talking about socialism?
Probably some evil, evil thing. Now, they just have semi-socialism, but yeah. They have socialized capitalism over there. They have socialized capitalism. But
now,
it does help, man, because look, all my friends like this. Look, I was so mad. I've got, umpteen jillion student loans, all this stuff. I go to school, pay for my own way, blah, 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 right? Work my way up from Mississippi trying to get out, and better my life. My friends over there, when I went to school, I thought I got a scholarship, go to the University of London. Everybody there, mandatorily free school, free degree, free everything, right? Because they think it's a state duty to provide an education for their citizens. So when I was going to school, they were paying to do so. They were all going to school free. And I was hanging out with all this. Well, one time I ate at a kebab shop, and I got food poisoning.
A kebab is like a
Middle Eastern dish. It's like they'll have lamb or beef or whatever on a spindle, and it's cooked, and you just shave it off and eat it in like a pita bread or something, But it's called kebab.
Oh.
But anyway, right. So
it's
anyway,
gyro.
I went to these
a
things
gyro.
Because, yeah, they're like, just like that. But they're called kebab shops over there. So anyway, I go to this kebab shops, because they're very cheap. You can get it for like £1, which is like, $1.50 or something. So I go eat there all the time, But I was in the street once. I ate one of these things, and this guy, they gave me bad food, right? I got very, very, very sick. So I got really, really sick that evening. So I said, I got to go back to the house. Yeah, I'm throwing up. I feel horrible. I go out, lay down. This on a Friday evening, lay down. I wake up Sunday in a hospital.
What?
And they're like, I'm like, what's happened? What's going on? And they're like, you're in a hospital.
Wait,
you were brought in.
Wait a minute. Where did you lay down at? In the street?
No, I went to my dorm room where I was going to school, right? And I went and laid down because I was feeling so bad that night because I got food poisoning. Well, I apparently started running a super high fever, and the next day I didn't come down to breakfast or class or anything. They went in there and they found me in my room, running like, you know, 106 fever or something, and they took me to a hospital. And I don't even remember any of it, right? So I wake up in the hospital the next day, feeling a lot better and everything, but they said, you know, oh, you're in the hospital, blah, blah. And I was horrified, mortified, because I didn't have any money, and I'm not from England. You know, I'm an American. And I tried to get up out of the bed. They're holding me down, saying, what's wrong? What's wrong? Stop, stop, stop. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I've got to call my mom. I've got to call the embassy or something, because this is, you don't understand, you know. I can't pay for this. I'm thinking, I just spent $10,000, you know, and right. I'm going to be held in this country or something. You know, this is a nightmare. And then they were like, no, you're fine, you're fine. They said, relax. They said, you're a student. And I'm like, I'm American. I'm not. No, it doesn't matter. They said, we take care of all students. It doesn't matter what nationality you're from, anything. He said, you get free medical. He said, relax. And so I stay in there, you know, I get out that evening doing a lot better and all, but I was in there for a weekend in a foreign country in the hospital, and I paid zero for that. And they saved my life. So there's a difference. In America, if that would have been, you know, I was a foreigner, and I got sick at McDonald's, I would have been thrown out in the garbage because I couldn't afford to pay, you know, $25,000 a day to stay in the emergency room.
Yeah, well, the CSI would have been looking at you because you would have been dead.
Yeah. And there would be, why is he wearing a medical gown, but he's in
that's
a
right,
dumpster?
That's right.
Let's investigate.
Right. Let's investigate, yeah. it wasn't CSI.
But see, that's the difference between us. A socialized economy and a not. They actually take care of people. And over there, you know, everybody retires at, you know, 55 or 60 and goes about their life, and everybody has good plans, but, you know, they don't have to pay for medical ever in their life and things like that. It's provided by the state. So they have a lot more savings. They have a lot more safety net all the way around, and they live quite comfortably. And it's a real shame that this country does not do that to help its citizens.
Well, but everybody is for themselves. You need to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps if you have boots. But the thing is that why do we have to help our neighbor? Why do we have to help anybody? And let me think. If you don't help the other person and the other person dies, who's going to help you when you're in trouble?
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
But you don't get in trouble because – you have all the money in the world, like Fat Boy Rush Limbaugh, when he had his heart attack, he just went in the hospital and just paid for it. Doesn't everybody have that? And if you don't,
well, here's the
it's
thing.
Your fault.
Like, let's use, you know, pick a city that's in distress, Cleveland, Detroit, somewhere that's in real distress. If you've got it all, you've got money going on, and you sit in your little palace, and you ignore all your neighbors, and you lock the door, and you tell them to go all, you know, elf off and die, well, when the whole city and the society around you collapses, you got nothing. You're living in a gutted, ruined city where people are scavenging, and as soon as you step outdoors, guess what? They're going to scavenge off of you, and they're going to find your corpse laying somewhere, and your TV is going to be carried down the street by the person who shot you because you have helped destroy the society around you. So you've got nothing. I mean, that's why I don't understand these people who are like, it's all about me. But if it's all about you, you can't be an island alone in the middle of a garbage dump. You know what I mean? And it really bothers me that greedy.
It's still a garbage dump. I like that.
Well, that's what it is.
Well,
these people, look at Detroit and all that. Everybody with any money has fled the city because they can't even live there anymore because they've destroyed the city because they won't support the city. You know what I mean? I mean, it's that simple.
Well,
if you support your neighbors, you could live in the best neighborhood ever and have you know, people strolling around going, good evening, with the lamps burning all day long and all the hedges trimmed perfectly, because they've supported each other. But that's the difference.
Well, the thing is, Sam Brownback, who is the governor of Kansas, they are, the state is going to go into bankruptcy.
The state?
Sam Brown, The state is going to bankruptcy because they are about $600 billion in debt. Now,
hey, you know what we need,
billion.
Mike? We need more tax cuts. That will solve this problem.
Oh,
they need the tax cuts.
Yes. And that's what he did when he became president. I mean, president. He thinks he wanted to be president.
He wants to be president.
He
became governor.
He, when he first became the governor, he said, we're going to tax. When I'm governor, we're going to get rid of the daggone taxes where nobody pays. This is going to be a state that where nobody is going to pay taxes. And he said, I want to accelerate how fast I can cut these taxes. When he first came in, he said, all right, here's what we're going to do. Right now he's saying, we have so many. We have thousands of businesses that are now new small businesses that are being formed in this country, in this state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they see that the
they don't pay
taxes. You're right. But the thing, what he did was he cut the taxes for small businesses down to zero. Okay.
Zero.
So what did the big businesses do? They all declared themselves, they changed their whole status, and they're all small businesses now. They cut up their businesses into various companies.
Right.
So
every department is
own
mom and pop shop.
You know, IBM is a mom and pop shop now in Kansas City.
Yeah.
So
that's because they can game the system and not pay anything.
That's right. That's right. They are gaming the system. They said we have a net growth of 36. We added 4,500 new businesses, small businesses. The problem is that in March report, the U.S. Census Bureau showed that more people are moving away from Kansas than moving in. The state had a net loss of 12,557 people between July 12th and July 2012 and July 2013. Between 2010 and 2013, the state gained 16,000 excess people, but lost 26,900 people, resulting in a net loss of 10,000. So the thing is, the state overall population did increase in that period, but that was driven by the burst and not by people deciding to move to Kansas from other states. The problem
right.
is now, Brownback dismissed the concerns that the state is projected to face, I said $200 million in 2017. But they have redone that. It's about $300 million. He said that he now wants to cut out all major businesses' taxes down to zero. So now when you have nobody paying taxes but you and me who live in the state, who work for as a teacher, who work for as a policeman, who work in a grocery store, who work in a cleaners, who work in a
it shifted
store.
The entire
the
tax
only
burden.
We're paying taxes now.
Yeah,
we're
so it shifted the whole tax
right.
burden. No business pays tax, only people pay tax.
Right, and that's why he's behind 12 points as running for governor for reelection.
That's ridiculous.
It's just outrageous.
Look,
absolutely.
It's all these guys. See, I don't understand this Republican mantra, this continued drumbeat for the last 20 years about not paying any taxes. You know, Dick Armey and all of them championed this stuff about, you know, we won't ever pay taxes again in America. But it's insane and it's stupid because you've got to pay for your infrastructure and your society around you, or else there is no business to have. You know, you can't drive a product down the gutted dirt road because the roads are falling apart. I don't understand the logic at all. And even taking the flip side of Republicanism, take the religious standpoint, since they're all, you know, they're very heavily, weirdly anti-government in the religion, but even in the Bible, if you look at it, Jesus says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, which is a way of saying pay your taxes Because the state has to function. I mean, he says it directly. He says it got nothing to do with your spiritual side, but you have to pay taxes. But that's the material side of life. So I don't understand why they hate taxes, because it's good for society.
Here's another thing for this moron Brownback. They estimated now 338 million less is going to be generated in 2014. And we
it's only going to get worse.
Right. You say too many rich people sold off stock in the previous year. He said that's the reason why. He said it's the price of creating jobs. Said Governor Brownback, it's the price of creating jobs. Said, okay. Now he said that Brownback and his fellow. Now there are Democrats and Republicans who are against Brownback being reelected because the Republican and see they're getting the just desserts because he promised them that they were going to be in the tent, but they're not Tea Party people. So now they see the, what's coming back.
Hey, they're the corporate party. And guess who's getting the tax cuts?
Ooh, yeah. And he says here the cuts, which largely benefited the wealthy, cost the state 8% of its revenue that is needed for schools and other government services. He said the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities noted that about the same as the effect of a mid-sized recession. Moody's also now cut the state's debt rating in April for the first time in at least 13 years, citing the cuts and the lack of confidence in the state's fiscal management. 2012 cuts were among the largest ever enacted by the state, reducing the tax bracket by 25% and eliminating all taxes on business profits that are reported on individual income returns. No other state has ever eliminated all taxes on these pass-through businesses. The cuts were aggregated, promoted by Brownback with the same disproven theory that Republicans have employed for decades. There will be no loss of revenue because of the economic growth. Well, how can a store get bigger if the people, 60% of the people who shop at the store can't shop there anymore? You only get rich people who shop.
I mean, that's why it's just stupid on the face. If you've got nothing, you have no money, and your entire infrastructure around you is falling down, how is any business going to grow? They're not. They're going to abandon the city just like they do the urban centers that are in plight right now. You know, you got to invest in it to survive.
Here's exactly what you're saying. He said Kansas, in fact, was one of only five states to show a loss of employment over the last 6 months. While the rest of the country was improving, it has been below the national average in job gains for 3.5 years since Mr. Brownback took office. Average
way to go.
The state are down in 2012, and so is the net growth in a number of registered businesses. Because all these people, these major companies now, are using a small business as a tax dodge. That's all they're doing.
Exactly. It's the same thing as if he had just declared himself U.S. Virgin Island or something, tax shelter, and they just all moved over there and claimed the P.O. box. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Hey, now, listen to this. Kansas is forced to chop away at its only hope for a real economic expansion, investment in public schools and colleges. While most states began restoring education funding after the recession, Kansas cut K-12 spending by 2% over the last two school years and higher education by 3%. Well, see, if you're not smart enough to know what he's doing, it's the best way to go at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it?
Hey, also, I'm pretty sure, Mike, that if you look at the numbers, when you start seeing things like that and you connect the dots, the way you pay for a tax cut with a business is to cut spending in another area. And isn't it ironic and weird how that coincides?
good. This guy says, he said, Brahman said, who's saying now, because he has a faltering campaign because of his mistake. This is what his campaign election person said as he resigned. He said, yet he continues to cling to his marginal ideology, pleading for more time. I need more time for the city to turn, for the state to turn around. He said, it's like, this is what Brownback said, it's like going through surgery. It takes a while to heal and get growing afterwards.
Well, you know what? Unfortunately, you may survive, but, you know, when you lose a few limbs and all that, you're not going to be walking around the next day or the next.
Well,
so that's just...
The Wall Street Journal said, but it's not clear the patient can recover from this surgery. The reserve fund, in fact, is likely to nearly run dry next year. As Kansas clearly shown, states cannot cut their way to prosperity. They need to use every tool of government to nurture growth, and those tools require money. This is what the conservative Wall Street Journal has said about Brownback.
You know, when you say that's the Wall Street Journal side of things, just imagine how bad it is. I mean, you know.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, here's the thing. It's a crying shame that we have a state, not even just a, we've already got cities, and that's just an insult to begin with, but we've got now a state in the richest nation, not just on Earth, but in the history of the Earth, and we are going into bankruptcy? Are you kidding me? I mean, it's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. There's enough money flowing like rivers through this city that we could, if he would just have a sensible tax code, he could probably pave every road in Kansas in freaking gold if he wanted to, because we got money to burn. But he is so stupid that he chopped off the only revenue base they got, and now they bankrupted an entire state. That's unbelievable, Mike.
Well, listen, there's a Los Angeles Times, the economy hub, Michael Hilsick, I believe, he says, how the Tea Party tax cuts are turning Kansas into a smoking ruin.
I love that title.
He said...
Yeah, nothing but burned down corn husks.
That's right. He said, Sam Brownback, the Republican governor of Kansas, doesn't just believe in whistling past the graveyard. He's whistling to stroll past it in full-throated song. He said, our new pro-growth tax policy will be like a shot of adrenaline into the heart of the Kansas City, Kansas economy. Right?
Mm.
He said, but Hiltzik says, instead job growth in Kansas trails the nation. The state's rainy day fund is dwindling to zero. Month after month, reserves come in even lower than fiscal official expectations. In the rest of the economy and the country, school budgets are fully beginning to recover. Okay, so who's benefiting? The rich, including those proud offspring of Wichita, Kansas, and the Koch brothers.
Huh.
Only one.
Imagine
that. He said, in the past years, in the past year, a record number of small businesses, more than 15,000, were formed. Oh, yeah, but the problem with that is...
That's because they all renamed themselves small businesses.
He said, yes, but as shown by the Center of Budget and Policy Priority, Hilsick says, a Washington economist think tank, 16,000 disappeared. He said, many of those businesses that Brownback crowed about were surely created to take advantage of one of the tax quirks Brownback enacted. This is the elimination of all taxes on partnerships, sole proprietorships, LLCs that passed through their tax liabilities to their owners. That allowed everyone from freelancers and petty contractors to huge partnerships to avoid any state taxes as long as they're organized as a certain type of small business.
Hmm.
I mean...
Well, there you go, Mike. That's your answer. We need to relocate the radio show to Kansas and become tax-free.
Hey, I tell you. He says,
we got a plan. Then he can have on paper, you know, another business forming in Kansas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they cut the daggone tax rates almost to zero. I think they're down to 3.5% now. And then
you know, here's the thing that blows my mind, Mike. Why the, I don't know, I don't blame the Democrats for it, but why they've allowed the greatest generation's success. You know, we'll make movies about it. We'll have specials on. We'll let Tom Brokaw write books about it, you know, whatever. We'll salute them when they walk by the parade and just drool on ourselves about the greatest generation success story. But when you then say, well, then let's apply the greatest generation success story, everybody goes, oh, no, what? You know, because nobody wants to do something that they did, and that was sacrifice like you wouldn't believe. They were paying, 60 to 90% tax rates? Well, 90 during the war and 60% later for businesses, you know? I mean, come on. You imagine? Could you imagine any president today even saying, hey, you know, we're at war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and there's a terror war on, and the World Trade Center fell, so we've all got to do our part, so I want all the businesses of America to pay 90% taxes. Could you imagine that statement?
Well, you know, the thing is, they were at 90%, but they never paid 90%. You know, they said 90%, but they never paid that. So the thing is that
it don't matter if they did or not. They were paying taxes.
They
were contributing.
Taxes, right.
So we had the biggest boom and the longest sustained boom in history. We dominated the earth. I mean, we became the superpower of the entire world because we invested in ourselves. It's that simple.
Well, how do you explain? And we're going to get to that. I will get to that. But I want to lead into something else that, about, and this concerns tax growth and centenarians. That's what we are here.
But maybe you speak
over,
for yourself, man.
This is right out of the U.S. Census Bureau population estimates, 2010 Census Special Report on Centenarians. The older population, people 65 years or older, numbered 43.1 million in 2012. Okay, that's the most recent estimate. That was 2012. They represent 13.7% of the U.S. population. And about one in every seven Americans. The number of older Americans increased by 7.6 million or 21% since 2002.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that's a big bulge, you know. Baby boom.
That's right. The baby boomers, okay? However, the number of Americans aged 45 to 64 who will reach 65 over the next two decades increased by 24%. Between 2002 and 2012, and by 2030, there will be about a 72.1 million older persons, more than twice the number in 2000, compared to the increase of 7% for the under 65 population. Now, that is, so, and I just want to go into this with one other thing here. In 2012, there was 24.3 million older women, 18.8 million million older men, or a sex ratio of 129 women for every 100 men. Where are these women at? I haven't seen them. Anyway, at the age of 85 and over, the ratio increased to 200 women for every 100 men. Okay? Now, here's the problem. What we're talking about back to my friend who lives across the street in Germany. He says, they don't worry about if they're getting food tomorrow. They have a pension. They're not worried about that. He said, when they have 30 days vacation and you must take it. You must take it, and it's paid when you go on vacation.
Yes. Yes.
Okay? If you get sick, you're paid for your day out.
Yep.
Now, if you just take off, don't report to work, you ain't getting paid. Well, why should you? But he says, yeah, they pay higher taxes. Yeah, their gasoline is higher. But the problem
But that's
is,
because they're paying for the services to support their society.
Well, 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 here's the thing. My daughter, my youngest daughter, she sits in her car in the driveway here for a half hour with the motor running. With the motor running, texting, when she's probably coming over to my house here. I'm looking at her out the window. She ain't got out of the car. She's texting. She's texting. She ain't talking on the phone. She's just texting and Facebooking. The car's running for a half hour. Then she comes in the house and says, oh, Dad, you know, I need some money for gas. I mean, what, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Oh, Lord.
So how do you stop that? You stop it by raising the price of gas. That's how you
well,
stop
you
it.
Actually, you run outdoors next time. You take the keys out of the ignition, and you throw them.
Well, hey, I'm not only paying for the gas, but I'm paying for the insurance, and I pay for the car.
Yeah.
I pay for the phone that she's using and that she's texting. So the thing is that
so what's wrong with this picture, Mike?
Here.
What's wrong with this picture? I thought the children are supposed to be supporting the adult.
Well, here's the thing. What's wrong with this picture is that we have it easier. You know, you look at all these shows on television, BBC or any show that's English. You look at their houses. Their rooms are half the size of our rooms.
Of course.
You know, I need
we
a
all have
house
McMansions.
Hey, I mean, my wife said, oh, you know, when IKEA first came, I said, oh, let's go over there and we get our furniture from IKEA. I said, this looks like a dollhouse. I don't want any of this equipment. I don't want any of this furniture. It's too small. So the thing is, oh, it's because it's built for European-style living.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like for American-style living.
Right.
So the thing is that everything is smaller, but people say over there that they're not complaining how high the gas is. They're not complaining that a steak might be $6. They're not complaining that McDonald's. I don't know. You ate over there. What was the price? And this was a couple of years ago, I understand. But what was the price?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it was more expensive. I was horrified. I would, you know, go in to get a burger or whatever, and it would be like, you know, 5 pounds or 6 pounds or something. You're like, oh, that's not bad. And then you realize that's like, you know, $9 or something. You're like, oh, my God, you know. But it's just the way it is, a little bit more expensive. But also, like I said, I also didn't spend $20,000 because I was in the hospital for an entire weekend. So, you know,
that's
where
right.
are the savings, right? You know, so a that's little right. bit goes a long way. Maybe you pay a
well,
little
yeah.
bit more for your burger, but, hey, guess what? You also get more.
Well, you know, it's just like right now, and at my house, I bought years ago, 15 years ago, 20,
mm-hmm.
15 years ago, I bought insurance to cover anything that went on in the house, you know, any electrical problems,
right,
goes out, all that stuff. So, you know, and my wife says to me, you know, why do you have to pay all this money every month? I go, well, you know. What's going to go wrong? Well, anything's going to run. You know, every time I go and buy an electronic, something electronic, I always buy insurance for it.
Right.
You know, and half the time, nothing ever goes wrong with it. And then I go and get another one, which is updated. So I did buy the insurance for it. Well, the one time I had a problem, remember, years ago, it was maybe about 10 years ago now, maybe. It wasn't that long, 7 years ago. My air conditioner went out because
right.
my air handler went bad.
Good yeah, thing
was
I remember
summertime.
That.
Summertime. Hey, they repair it or replace it. They could
mm-hmm.
not repair it. They sent
right, because you had the older model. It had been there forever, and they had to build get a new one in it because they couldn't rebuild it or anything.
Years,
yep, I remember that.
26 years. 26 years the house was here. And they put a new one in, $2,200. What did
yep.
I pay? $60. That's all I paid.
Exactly.
So, all right, that one air handler was worth all the money that I spent, was worth more than all the money I spent over the years. So you say
that insurance.
That's right. If you paid $30 a month back then,
right,
and you pay that for a year, what's that, $360? Yeah. So you're $360, and if it times, say, 10 years, that's $3,000. But it wasn't 10 years when it went out. It was about, when I bought it, maybe it was about 5 or 6 years. So I had, the air handler cost more than what I had put into it. So
right.
You never know.
But then you're covered on anything that goes wrong.
That's right.
And that's the point.
That's
all it takes is one thing, and you're completely screwed. I mean,
well, just like you going in the hospital, it took one time for you go in the hospital, and you would have been bankrupt.
Oh yeah.
One time. That's
yep.
all.
Just like that. That's what happens to Americans all the time. You know, one illness, one car wreck, and they're wrecked. Their whole family is flushed, and that's what's wrong with our economy.
Well,
everybody's like living on the edge, hanging with their fingernails, and as soon as it, you know, it breaks, you fall to your death. You know, it's not a good system.
Well, of course, it's not a good system, but the problem is, what are we going to do with?
What we're
going
to do, Mike, is cut taxes to zero. And that will create a system of repetitive growth in imaginary numbers that reinforces the ledge that you're hanging on so that you never plunge to your death because it's all fantasy. You see how it works out?
At that time, we now have someone that can tell us about that, about plunging. Thinking about the old time things, Grace, we were talking about M Squad,
yeah,
and Richard Diamond's things and Peter Gunn. Ben Casey was a major thing that focused on one person, him. You see?
Oh, he did everything.
But, absolutely. And now, see, when we were talking, have you heard anything we were talking about?
I did. I heard it right after the cut taxes for everybody, which I absolutely disagree with, but, you know, that's okay.
Well, listen, no, that's what he, Brownback, is trying to do, but it's not for everybody.
It was completely tongue-in-cheek, I understand, but Brownback thinks that that's the best thing to do. But then we all know Brownback's a moron.
There is that,
now,
you know.
Right,
and now, and now his own party is against him. Now the Republicans are even against him. He will not win re-election.
Here's one of the things, and I'll say this for the doctor here that's on, because I think she'll understand exactly what I'm saying. One of the things that bothers me most, you know, Mike, we talked for years. You know, we are technically liberals, but we also understand and respect the need for balance and for different perspectives in life. So you can't have all of one thing. You've got to always have a little bit of something. So I understand the theory or whatever you want to call it when the Republicans say, hey, we need to lower taxes, we need to release burdens on businesses, let them grow and all that. Okay, we all get it. You know, you don't always have to have the, like we were talking about earlier in World War II, 90% tax rack. Okay, got it.
Right.
But you've got to have some common sense. You know, there's got to be balance. You've got to have everybody pay some, and then everybody gets along. No, I know. I said common sense. That's not a thing that they know. But my point is, just like in medicine, you know, you get these extremists who, like let's say the people who don't believe in medicine, they believe you can just pray away, you know, cancer or something. Though we have now proven over and over again that attitude, prayer, meditation, any of these type things can actually profoundly affect your health. You know, just your mental health alone can be changed dramatically by your mood and everything. But it is farcical and stupid if you sit there and say, well, then since prayer is good for me, I reject all medicine and I reject all surgery and, you know, we don't need anything else. It's in God's hand. You've got to have balance and a little bit of everything. And that's the way you survive,
well,
you know. And the same way with these economies. They've got to have some taxes and they've got to have some sensible policies or else they're going to go bankrupt like Kansas just did. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but you see, right. Dr. Grace, have you ever run into any people like that who come to you and say, oh, no, I don't need to have this done because I will just, oh, I'll just go home and pray.
Oh,
have you met anybody like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, you see, here's the thing. Chris Meesmer and Larry Burridge, who were unfortunately, the county commissioners in Cabarrus County, but they leave office in November because they got trounced in the primary. They were commissioners assigned to the Council on Aging, and Meesmer never showed up at any meeting. And when Larry Burridge finally did show up at one meeting, and he was given the whole litany of complaints and demands and requests from the Council on Aging, the seniors, his response was, pray. That was his response, pray. Jesus will take care of you, just pray. You got to wonder how someone like that gets into office. Seriously.
Well, and you see, you led right into the thing that I wanted to talk about. See, now, here's a thing on aging, 65 plus. There are 7.7 million men and women still working in this group. Still working in this 65 plus age group. 4,300,000 men, 3,400,000 women. This is 2012. He said, now, these are U.S. workers, 65 plus, unemployed, and still looking for work is 6.2%. Okay? And this is from the National Institute of Retirement. Now, these are people now who are still looking, 65 plus, 6.2%, who have no money to retire, 38 million working aged Americans. Out of this group, 45% have no retirement savings, 55% have some retirement savings.
So you're basically 50-50 have nothing.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right. And when I spoke to my friend, Eddie Gill, across the street, he said, hey, his whole family, ain't none of them worried about nothing. They all got retirement. They're all retired early, well, before 65 or 65. And they work for Mercedes and Jaguar. Said, we got great pensions. He ain't worried. He said, they wonder why he was still working. Okay.
Right.
Now,
well,
now,
you know, the one of the biggest myths that has been perpetrated and the biggest lies that has been perpetrated on the American population is that unions are bad. That's one of the biggest lies the biggest cons, the biggest scams, you know, that has been perpetrated on the American public. Unions are bad. Well,
unions are bad.
Unions are responsible for your 40-hour week. They're responsible for overtime. They're responsible for child labor laws that prevent big business and the robber barons from capitalizing and abusing children, using them as labor. You know, unions are responsible. In the 1950s, when unions had their heyday, that was when daddy could go to work, mama could stay home, and daddy could make a good living. I'm not saying that, you know, women should stay home, but I'm saying that you could live on a one income. You could live on one income, and you could still send your children to college. And now you got both parents working sometimes two and three jobs each, and they can hardly afford to put food on the table, much less think about sending their children to college.
Absolutely.
You know,
amen.
That's absolutely correct. But see, hey, here's the thing now. In the Gallup did a poll on uninsured okay, on uninsured and U.S. in the first quarter, in the U.S., in the first quarter of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
It was 14.7%. And in the third quarter, it steadily rose into 2013 to 18%. Today, in 2014, it's down to 13.4%, the lowest since 2008.
Yeah.
This is the uninsured in the U.S. It's down. Now, so we're talking about...
That's probably because of that communist terrorist takeover of the healthcare system that we've been trying to repeal.
Yes.
It's so terrible.
That's what it is. It's a horrible thing. It really is. But, before we go any further, let me finish my point about the unions.
Yeah.
And it was in the 50s, because we had the unions, that we had such good wages and we had such good life. Because of the unions. But big business was afraid and didn't like the fact, they were greedy. They didn't like the fact that the little person had actually bargaining power. So they proceeded to destroy the unions. And the biggest union buster of all time was Ronald Reagan.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. He started the whole thing. He started the whole thing with the daggone controllers, with the air traffic
controllers. And so anytime now we can go full circle and come back into the whole healthcare thing. So anytime there's been any kind of proposal to level the playing field where the working person can get the same benefits as the rich person can get, there seems to be a hue and a cry from the rich and their minions, of course, the people in Congress who are bought by the rich people. There's a hue and a cry calling it communism. Well, I'm gonna make a whole bunch of people's hair stand on end right now. But is that communism? I want it.
absolutely. Well, sure. Well, see, here's the thing. Reagan got away with that because the union that he first busted, that started this whole thing, the air traffic controllers, did not want the other unions. Like, I was in the electronic end of it. There was a maintenance end of it. They did not want to be a part of that because they thought they were elite. And see, it was the air traffic control. See, I worked with these people. I know them. I worked with them every day. And what happened was we asked them, said, look, come in to be a part of our electronic and maintenance union.
Right.
Then he cannot fire you because, you see, how many wires do you think are under the runways at LaGuardia or Kennedy or Los Angeles Airport? How many wires? There's trillions of miles. So if we all walked out on strike, he could not fire us because he could not get anybody to take our place who would be able to look and find these. Because some of these wires, you had to be there for a long time and be handed down to, this is where it's at. It all wasn't on paper. But you see, the air traffic controllers, he fired them in a microminute and boom, Navy air traffic controllers. A traffic controller is a traffic controller. It don't matter. You can learn the other job, but you can't learn where wires are that aren't on any blueprint if no one's going to help you find them. So, but they didn't want to do that, so he fired them. And they regretted. Then they tried to come back into our unit, but it was too late then. They're already fired. So some unions now, I believe, did get a little ahead of themselves and thought they were elitist. But the air traffic controllers were. So the thing is that, but on a whole, every union, mostly every union, was there for, was established for the working man. I mean, you had the famous quote by Henry Ford said, I'm not building the cars for rich people, for five rich people to buy. I'm buying the cars for 10,000 minimum and poor people to buy. I'll make more money doing
yes.
that.
Exactly.
But these people in charge of this country now don't believe in that. Because they said, we don't care if we sell only 5 cars to the rich people. Because we're going to sell them for $100 million each. And they'll
right.
pay
so
for
it's
it.
The same difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same difference. So they just boost up the price of the car so only the elitists can buy it.
Right.
And the elitists, stupid, say, well, we don't want to buy that car too priced. They go out and buy it because it is a high price. They think that's status by spending the money.
That is status, exactly. Exactly.
So
the whole concept
that we have, that we had since Henry Ford to today has completely been turned on its head.
Mm-hmm.
On the value of things.
Well, that's what the one thing that I think people don't realize how dire it is, but we have had a, you know, corporate revolution in this country, and they have taken over and set up a corporocracy where they can control everything. And it's very, very, very dire for the American people because we're on the brink of, you know, not being able to fix things. But they're doing profound damage. And it is all about the corporation and not the person. And we're going to see more and more and more of this. I mean, we're seeing cities all over the country now facing bankruptcy, and now we got the first state. I don't see a hue and a cry anywhere on the corporate-run media about it. I don't see people in the street about it. You know, we collapsed the entire economy. In the 80s, we sent everybody to jail. This time, we got zero bankers in jail, zero. So, what's going on in this country? So
well,
people need to break up.
That man needs to be in jail. I mean, for God's sake, that man needs to be in jail. But here's the thing also. I don't see anyone from the right-wing media saying, oh, wow, look at that. He mismanaged. Now, they were very quickly to jump all over Detroit's crisis, you know, mm-hmm. and point to the liberal Detroit, right? They were very willing to do that, but I don't see any one of them criticizing Brownback, do you?
No.
Right.
Go ahead.
I mean, you can look at this this chart on the monthly growth incomes, and it's just completely unbelievable. You have California in July 2012. You see, their monthly growth rate was, I mean, almost twice what it is for
mm-hmm.
Kansas. That they
mm-hmm.
have. They're right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are $338 million in debt,
right.
And they're projected to be close to $500 million before this man gets out of office.
Yep.
Well, look, Mike, if you look back in California alone, under Schwarzenegger, they went into a deficit crisis. They went into crisis, and they almost went bankrupt. And they kept having
right.
to borrow and borrow, and they were horribly in the red, and there was an actual, literal crisis out there where we almost lost that entire state. And
mm-hmm.
they were in profound debt. And then now, under Democratic leadership, they have bounded back just like Clinton did. They have bounded back and recovered the deficit, and they're now positive again. They're back in the green. But nobody talks about it.
Well, you say even Arnold Schwarzenegger has said recently, a year ago, said that my biggest mistake was cutting taxes.
Exactly.
He said, I listened to that group, the Tea Party group, and I cut the taxes. But it was my
mm-hmm.
biggest mistake. He said, now California, under Jerry Brown, who successfully pushed to raise taxes after the recession, the state's job growth since then has left Kansas and the country as a whole in the dust.
Yeah,
yep.
Well, guess what? North Carolina is going to go the way of Kansas.
Oh,
if this
absolutely.
Legislature in Raleigh.
Oh, with that
flat
tax.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they're idiots. They're cutting. The revenue has diminished dramatically.
Yes.
And they can't figure out why. Because, you morons, you cut taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
it's a one for one. You know.
Yeah, but see, you're absolutely right. They said they can't figure out why, because it just can't be that we cut taxes, and that's a problem. It just can't be that.
Can't possibly
now
be.
That, Now, also, we're talking about insurance here. He said they found that among the uninsured, rate fell significantly for people with low and moderate incomes in the states that had Medicaid expansion.
That's right.
He said, now, the decline to only kind of states where Obamacare was fully implemented. In states where Medicaid expansion in Medicaid expansion states, it was even larger drop of 39%. In states where Medicaid expansion was not expanded, there was 0 or -1 decline.
There you go.
Said, now, this was by the Commonwealth Fund track the question, how satisfied are you with the ACA coverage? Republicans stated 74% said they were satisfied. 17% said they were not satisfied. Democrats, who were asked the same question, said 85% were satisfied and 9% were not satisfied. Independents said they were 82% satisfied and with the overall a problem, and only 13% said they were not satisfied. So when you ask them if they liked Obamacare, Republicans, 74% said they were not satisfied. These people, it's like the mule. You put the blinders on the mule and the horse so they can't see anything around them. They can only see straight ahead.
Yeah, but if you ask them if they like the Affordable Care Act, they say yes. They don't like Obamacare, but they like the Affordable Care Act. But they're idiots.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Well, that's what they're right. But see, they have the blinders on. They had the blind. I mean, 74% of Republicans said they were satisfied with the ACA. But when you ask them about Obamacare, 75% said they're not satisfied with it. So they have no idea. And that's
not a clue.
No, right. They have no idea because of the coverage that they're getting in their own little small world by Rush Limbaugh and Fox News. And this whole thing, they have to figure out a way that they have to damage this man so it can be a spot on his record. Since he's almost, and I don't know, but he seems to be pure as a driven snow, he has no outside things that they can get him on. They can't get him on any criminal acts.
They've had Monica Lewinsky's like buzzing at the front door all day. You know, nobody's answering.
Absolutely, because the only one that answers is his wife, and she ain't getting in.
Yeah, Michelle.
So the thing is that these people, because they made the statement, there was no way for this man to get elected, and after he got elected, he was going to be a one-term president. Now it seems where he became a second-term president, they look like asses.
Yep.
They are asses.
Hey, look.
How do
Mike,
you explain
no, that? I can tell you, Mike, I can tell you the big mistake that Obama made. Huge mistake.
Yes.
The one thing he did wrong. Instead of having it be the Affordable Care Act, which sounds so bland and, you know, blah, 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 nobody knows. He should have just had it named the Romney Health Care Cutting and Slashing Bill or something.
There you go.
And then the Republicans would have loved it and just jumped all over it, you know.
But see, here's
just
the problem.
It's all branding.
No, they would not. This is the problem. They would not like it even then because they
I know. I'm just picking.
Not to like anything. If he went right now and said, let's send troops into Ukraine right now and blow them all to hell, the only one that would be on his side would be McCain and Graham.
No. You know what? If he did that, McCain and Lindsey Graham would be against him. I'm telling you tomorrow.
The odd couple you're talking about? McCain and Lindsey?
Yeah,
the odd couple.
The odd couple, right.
I mean, the next day they'd say that he had damaged, you know, 20 years of progress with the Russian, you know, Renaissance or something. It wouldn't matter what he did, Mike.
They need.
If he went into North Korea and removed that guy, destroyed all their nuclear weapons, and set up, you know, a free democratic republic, they would complain. I mean, it doesn't matter what he does.
Well, you're absolutely right. The thing is, though, that they need to establish something. Now, what do you think, Dr. Lynn Galloway, about how far are we along in North Carolina going bankrupt without...
rolling merrily along, oblivious to the reality, absolutely rolling merrily along. And I'm going to tell you that if this legislature stays in Republican hands, then North Carolina flipping deserves what they get. They deserve what they get. We deserve what we get. Because if people stay home and don't come to the polls, then by golly, y'all deserve what you got. And I don't want to hear about it.
I've been saying this for such a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing that's happened in this state in the last 3 years has been because we did not vote.
I talked to somebody the other day, and I said, you need to vote this November. Oh, we don't have to worry about Obama still in office for 2 more years. No, you don't get it. You got to go vote this November. Obama cannot do it by himself. He's got to have the support. He's got to get his back. Oh, my gosh, I was ready to strangle him.
Here's the problem. Why is it? See, this is why I was saying this, that when Obama became in office, everybody thought there was going to be a chicken in every pot.
Yeah.
I mean, have you seen this? There's a new TV series on a sci-fi channel called Dominion.
No, I haven't. I watched part of it, but I heard it's very good.
Well, you need to go on demand and catch up, because I want to tell you, this is so similar. I'll give a short background of it. This thing whole started because God left. So you know, what do you mean God left? He disappeared. So the archangels that were in charge was Michael the archangel and Gabriel. Now, I don't know why they always have Gabriel as the bad guy, but Gabriel said God left because humans were no good. They did not do what they needed to do to help themselves. So God got sick of it, and Gabriel came down to earth. He said he's going to kill all the humans, and then God will come back. So Michael said, no. This is God's creation, and he made them that way, but they just need good leadership. So Michael came down to protect them. So they created, Gabriel wiped out half the people in the country, in the U.S., because they're only talking about the United States now, not talking about the rest of the world.
The United States is the world, right?
That's right. Absolutely right. You don't need to talk about France or England. So the thing is that so Michael comes down and he makes a stronghold where he can fight these bad angels who are on the side of Gabriel. And guess where the stronghold is? Las Vegas. He creates almost like a dome over Las Vegas, and they have these machine guns because the angels fly and they're automatic tracking. When bad angel comes in into the area, they shoot
GPSs.
The angels down.
Huh? Amazing. Personal GPS.
So the thing is here, the question was, Michael was saying, too. They have a so he doesn't rule. He lets the humans rule, but he guides them. And what he did was, and the whole story is like the Savior is coming. You know, like the Matrix. The Matrix, uh-huh. The whole thing was what was the Christ was coming. The Savior was coming to save everybody.
Right.
I mean, it's just like the story of Christ in Jerusalem. He had to go through the growing up to learn everything, and then he was going to save everybody. I mean, the same thing with the Matrix. You know, he was there. He was the one, and he was going to. So anyway, that's what this story is. He saved this baby and hid him and took care of him growing up. Anyway, so the thing is that they asked Michael, well, why? Why did God disappear? So Michael seems to know that God didn't disappear, that he could do whatever he wants and he could disappear to them. But
yeah, he's God,
wanted,
after all. He can do whatever he wants, right?
That's right. So the whole thing was that, hey, I want the people down there to start taking care of themselves, each other. Take care of each other, not being selfish, and you're your own person, and you don't need anybody else. That's what he wants mankind to do. So this is the storyline. So this is the same thing here. I mean, if people do not want to help themselves...
Are you trying to say, Mike, that God has left Kansas?
Yeah, and he's about to leave North Carolina. He's about to leave North Carolina.
Yeah?
Yep.
That's what
and
I'm
all
talking
the
to
other
you.
Red states.
And
all
the
other
red
states. Mm-hmm. Texas,
right.
Too. Oh, God's left Texas. God left Texas a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, left Texas a long time ago. Long time ago. Right. He just left it up to the daggone hurricanes and the people coming across the border. Who? Now, here's the thing. Who? I just have a question.
Well,
who is going to pick the strawberries in California if we send all these immigrants back?
Don't ask the hard questions,
Congress.
Mike.
The members of Congress. How about that?
The members of Congress are going to do this? Well, don't
the members
you think
of Congress,
they,
yeah.
Well, when they only go to work 81 days a year, don't you think that
but
they should only get paid?
Of time. They got plenty of time. They only go to work in Congress 81 days of the year. Look at all the other days they could spend picking cotton or whatever the heck it is. Apples, oranges, you know?
I'm starting to like this plan.
Don't you think, though, that if they work 81 days a year, they should get paid for those 81 days a year and then have a part-time
nothing
job?
Nothing else. Yes.
And have a part-time job?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I'd love to see a senator hanging out at, like, you know, Blockbuster or somewhere.
Well, hey, you got to remember, like, I when I grew up in Brooklyn, loved the Dodgers, and I loved to see Carl Ferrillo and Jackie Robinson and Pee Wee Reese and Gil Hodges. And after the season, Gil Hodges worked at a car dealership. Roy Campanella had his own liquor store. Carl Ferrillo worked for the city as a garbage collector. They didn't get paid for not playing baseball. That didn't happen until it changed.
Right.
I guess it was Don Drysdale and Sidney Koufax when they held out. But the thing is
I like the moral of that story, Mike, is that one guy worked at a liquor store. Smart man.
Yeah, I like that one. Me too. That's the same thought.
So what are we... What are we to do as far as now having a this prime example of people who don't want to help themselves? What do we do here?
Well, you can bring as Dorothy Parker said, you can bring a horticulture, but you can't make her think, right? You can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So all we can do is educate, educate, educate. And that's all we can do. Short of you know, hijacking them, throwing them in a van, and driving them to the polls, I don't know what else we can do. But our job is to educate. That's the only thing we can do. Education is our weapon.
Well, I tell you what, there is a education that really needs to be done in Chicago. What can we do to stop the shootings in Chicago?
Oh,
as a matter of fact,
gosh, that's not an easy fix, Michael. That's a tough thing.
As a matter of fact, I want you to listen to this. This is my introduction to Chicago. Right here, we now have joining us Mr. David Adams. How are you, David?
Michael, how was you? It's always a pleasure, sir.
The champion.
Hi, David.
Yeah, Thomas, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks,
I think I heard the Doc on there. How you doing, Doc?
Hey, good, and, David. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Did you recognize that theme, anybody? That was the theme.
I did not.
That was the color version, the theme for The Untouchables.
That's right. Peter Gunn or The Untouchables, one of the two.
That was the new theme from the Sean Connery version of The Untouchables. But I had already played the original theme for The Untouchables at the start of the show. The original theme from TV was Robert Stack.
Right.
Wait a minute. Let's we can do that again. The original.
Oh, Dr. Gray's still tempting.
Here it is. Right here. Here it is. Yeah, so you remember that, Dr.
See, that's the version I recognize.
Yeah.
I like the version from the Sean Connery version also, because, you know, he was nominated for Academy Award for that, Sean Connery. Anyway, getting back to Chicago. Now, I mean, I cannot believe, I called this, one of the, who is it, Josh Voorhees, he calls it, Blood on the 4th of July, Chicago's deadly gun fuel holiday weekend was only marginally worse than last year's deadly gun fuel holiday
Unbelievable.
Weekend. He said 82 people were shot in an 84-hour window, according
Holy
to the Chicago Times. 14 were dead by Monday morning, including two boys aged 14 and 16 who were killed by police in separate incidents when they allegedly refused to drop their guns. Things were so chaotic Sunday night that officers responding to the spasm of violence reportedly kept interrupting one another on their radios to report still a new burst of gunfire. The string of shootings garnered national media attention and prompted Mayor Rahm Emanuel to plead for residents of money to put down their guns. Wherever you are, wherever you live, the gun violence that was part of this weekend is totally unacceptable. And it's Emmanuel Tully, gathering of concerned citizens on the city's south side. Now, it is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. Now, what they said is that it says here the chance, there's a chance the dead and injured from this July 4th won't be fully counted in Chicago's official crime statistics. It says here that they are trying to manipulate the statistics so it doesn't show how many people are actually getting shot and killed. So David, well, what can you bring and tell us about what's been going on lately?
Yeah, well, Michael, that, I mean, you and I talk, anytime you got 82 people shot in any town in a three-day period, it's just unacceptable. Rahm Emanuel and other city officials in the city of Chicago, I don't know what the problem is. They need to bring in the National Guards. I have called for this as early as April of this year, to call in the National Guards or some military presence in the city of Chicago, because at this juncture with the volume of people that are being shot, it's all about public safety. Okay, and I just don't believe that the story that they're giving us is that this is all related to drug dealers fighting for drug turf. Okay, and there's allegedly supposed to be some Mexican cartel that's supposedly funneling drugs in it that's creating all this gun violence in the city of Chicago. But if you listen, as you just described in that article, two of those kids were the 14-year-old and 16-year-old. They were shot by Chicago City police officers. That had nothing to do with drugs. Okay,
right.
And then also most of these kids. What are the statistics you have, Michael, on school-age kids? The volume of school-age kids that have been shot.
Yes.
Okay, because I think you and I talked about that.
Yep. Yeah, well, it says here that, well, the Chicago Police Department is cutting down all the details. I mean, they're trying to use every trick in the book to officially deflate the city's homicide and violent crime numbers. As a reporter, David Bernstein, said, David Bernstein and Noah Isaacson were able to identify 10 people who were beaten, burned, suffocated, or shot to death in 2013. All these cases were reclassified as death investigation, downgraded to a more minor crime or even close to non-criminal incidents. So,
see, that's the problem. That's the other problem, too, Michael. There was a big talk about that at the beginning of the summer, how they're fudging the numbers. The number of shootings are actually a lot worse, okay, than they're reporting.
Yes, right, absolutely right. He said, the overall number.
But either way, that's a side effect of the problem.
Yes, that's right. He said, but
I mean, that's just political cover.
Yeah.
Right. The overall numbers obscure the fact that Chicago, as a city of neighborhoods, and much of the violence has been sequestered in poor and predominantly black areas of the city where gang violence goes largely unnoticed unless it comes in bunches, as it did the past weekend. This is the 4th of July. After crunching the numbers, homicide numbers for 2000 and 2010, University of Yale sociologist Andrew, Pastor something or other, said the murder rate was about 3.1% per 100,000 residents living in north side of Jackson Park. Less than 10 miles away in West Garfield, the rate was 20 times that. It was 64 people per 100,000. So, the thing is that it's in a small area. Well, if you know the area, how come you can't clean it up?
Right.
Yeah.
What's the problem here?
I told you earlier, Mike, they should go in there and they should do the community-style policing where they put a cop on every corner and they have neighborhoods that they stay in, they know the people, and they police it. And they need to shut this down, because what that is it's like they cordoned off an area and they just said, y'all go, Wild West, and we won't come in, And it's going ape. Well, they should come in, shut it down, and then they should do something to alleviate the problems that caused it in the first place, like the poverty and the education. But they've got to stop shooting first.
The Tuesday after 4th of July, while Emanuel was speaking to the Southside people about this, two more people died from gunshot wounds over the weekend. They were shot on the 4th of July, and they died. 11 more people were shot when he was making the speech, including a 23-year-old young man riding his bike and a 17-year-old boy who was walking through the park with a group of friends. The team was set to start college orientation on Thursday of that week. Both died at the scene. And another thing. Just listen. The Chicago murder rate is 10 times worse than the Al Capone gangland rate. Now, what is all that about?
10 times worse than Capone?
Yes. He says, let's compare 2 months. It says here, 1929 in January, leading up to the St. Valentine's Day murder, which was February 14th. Okay? And to January 2013, 42 people were killed in Chicago last month, the most in January since 2002, and far worse than the city's most notorious crime area at the end of the Roaring Twenties. Even the image of Chicago perpetrated by Hollywood over the years was that mobsters routinely mowed down people on the streets. The crime stats tell a different story. The 2013 bloodshed had caught the attention of the Chicagoans, politicians, the White House, and people around the world. And the mobsters only shot other mobsters. They didn't shoot innocent people. Because you know why? That was bad for business. It was bad for business. So they did not indiscriminately shoot people. See? So... what we have here is, David, tell us, what do we have here?
Well, number one, Michael, like you and I talked about on yesterday, where the hell are these guns coming from? Number one, okay, you know, I mean, last I checked, there's no gun manufacturer. There may be some in the state of Michigan, okay, or the state of Illinois somewhere, but at last I checked, Chicago wasn't a major hub for gun manufacturing. Okay. First thing we need to do is to determine where the volume of guns are coming from and how young people are having access to guns on the streets of Chicago. You know, how come there's not more police presence in school areas where these kids have to go back and forth to school? You know, the volume of school-age kids shot in Chicago within the last 5 years is just of biblical proportions. You know, I think that you and I talked about some of those stats a little while ago. I don't have them in front of me, but you're talking about somewhere roughly 3,500 kids that have been shot in Chicago in the last five years. Okay, and nobody's talking about this.
Well,
nobody's
talking
about this.
We have another listener that wants to come on the line here. Hello, who's this?
Michael, this is Chairman Randy Zoller. How you doing?
How are you doing?
I'm all right.
Hi, Randy.
So,
how you doing?
How are you, sir? So,
I'm great.
Were you listening to what we were talking about?
I heard the tail end of that. I grew up around Chicago, so I'm quite... The situation with guns and violence, I mean, we grew up with that when I was coming up. Ben Wilson, the number one player out of high school, Simeon, was killed that famous shooting in 1986.
I
mean, he was a teammate of Nick Anderson. He went on to play for the Orlando Magic. But Ben was the best player in the country and was killed in a shooting near Simeon.
Now, where was that at? Simeon? Was that Chicago, part of Chicago?
Yeah, Simeon High School, same school that Jabari Parker went to.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Okay. So, why is it that a lot of these shootings are in front of schools, right in front of school, down the block from school?
Why do I think that?
Yeah, why do you think that? Yeah.
It's a very complex issue to weigh into, but I mean, clearly the availability of firepower plays into it, and much like you increase I had this debate with my father-in-law, who's a doctor, but also is a big Second Amendment advocate, and I asked him point blank. I said, "Well, if I increase the quantity or amount of risk factors for cancer." Wouldn't you agree that over time, if I keep smoking lots of cigarettes, a pack, two, three, four a day, that I'm likely to get cancer? And he said, yes. And I said, so why doesn't it hold when I increase the amount of handguns available to a population? It will ultimately increase the likelihood that there will be an accidental shooting or a shooting that is done on purpose. And then he looked at me, and he would not answer.
Yeah. I mean, So then why? I mean, here is a doctor, and he knows what the risk factors are. When you increase anything, something else has to give. I mean,
yes.
That's with anything. You just can't increase something and expect nothing to happen from it. So I don't understand how people can say that when you increase the gun power, well, that nothing's going to happen. And what you said, David, gun manufacturers are not in Chicago. They're not in Chicago.
I mean, if you actually look at it, the gun manufacturers, the folks that invest with these on Wall Street, there's a number of venture capital funds that pushed and invested in these gun manufacturers in order to make a profit. But I want to address a side issue here about guns that goes back to when I grew up.
Okay, but before you do that, I need to introduce you. This is the chairman of the Democratic Party in North Carolina. I mean, it was like when he came on, it was just a regular caller. And because he is a regular caller to the show, but he's the chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party, Randy Bowler, and you are on a what is it, once a week, or is that just going to be once in a while? You're going to be on that other station?
No, we have a new radio show down out of Fayetteville that the folks brought me on. They have What's Going On that comes from 6 to 9, and I have the 8 to 9 slot, and it segues into Wake Up. That's out of Fayetteville, WIDU, 1600 AM. You can actually hear it online or hear it live. And then they have two other stations down in Robeson County and another county that they're also played on. And I decided with the owner that I would go on and answer questions about the community and what we could do to push the dialogue. And my goal, Michael, is simple. I would like once and for all before I die in politics that we do not have to vote for the lesser of two evils. I would like to finally say we're voting for the better of two goods. Now, that could be a Sisyphean task, but that's my goal.
I love that. So, I love that statement.
Are you holding your breath or what?
I'm working on it, Michael. The long-term project.
Yeah, well, it's just like I was just explaining about the new series called The Dominion. And that's what it is. I mean, it's a lesser of two evils. So, you know, but getting back to
Chicago
here.
But you know what? That is such a simple thought. And it makes you step back a minute, because when you say it, it's the first time you ever have heard it. Because you never hear it. You only hear lesser of two evils in public discourse. And it's the same way with, like, there are simple things in life. Like, I'm a fan of I know Kucinich and other people have promoted it, but I'm a fan of that very simple thing. It's like, why don't we have a Department of Peace?
That's a very good question.
You know, and it's those kind of simple statements that make you rethink the entire world. And it's so simple, but why don't we just always strive for the better of two goods? That's a brilliant thing. I love that.
Well, thank you. It came to me while I was out doing this as I'm doing my job, and I finally just said, you know, after my years of being an elected official and being this party chairman, why can't we strive for that? Why can't we have all the participants, Republican, Democrat, Green Party, Libertarian, unaffiliate, focus on the better of two goods. Why can't we raise the consciousness instead of going down to the lowest common denominator? And that's going to be my life's work, Michael, and so this radio show is part of that.
Well, that is fantastic, but I just want to read some figures for you. In the Chicago, since Ms. Jeremy said you were from Chicago at one time, and I know David's been involved with this. Everything's going on in Chicago. There's a in 2012, okay, now this is 2014, I should say, there were 207 homicides so far. 2013, there was 440. So we're approaching, we're halfway there, and the year is half over. I mean, we're going to be right there where it was before. The Chicago logged 18 gunshot homicides in the last week through the afternoon, and many of the killings occurred on the south side. So what is it about the south side, Mr. Jeremy, of Chicago?
Well, first of all, actually those numbers are lower than the ones I grew up with. My high school was a Catholic school in Gary, Indiana. When it was people used to call it Murder USA because of the murder rate.
Yep.
Ironically, those numbers you quoted are lower than when I was growing up. It's just now.
Is that right?
Yes. If you go back and look, I can remember numbers above 500. Actually, if you look at Miami in the cocaine cowboys era of the late 70s, early 80s, they were above those numbers. But the issue is the school shooting. I mean, the predominance of where the shootings are and who's getting affected. I mean, you know what a Chicago typewriter was, what they used to call that? A Tommy gun.
A Tommy gun, correct, right.
That's from
Tommy
way back
gun, right.
In the 20s. There's been a tremendous amount of violence in the city, and they worked hard to get it out. But the reason I think you see the use of violence and the way that it's manifesting, and, of course, it's getting people's attention nationwide, is that the skills to resolve conflict have defaulted toward using weaponry, and the easiest weaponry for someone to get their hands on that wouldn't require physically wrestling your opponent, which is what a lot of young men do. You know, Michael, you and I grew up, you know, that way, playing sports and kind of rough and tumble.
Absolutely.
They pull out guns. And that started back in the 80s when guys started getting a hold of Saturday Night Specials and all that snub-nosed 357s. It's just gotten worse because they're easily available to get. And people don't have the skills or taught the life skills to say, you know what, I disagree with you. I'm really angry. You hurt my feelings. I'm upset. So we're going to resolve this in a way that's not going to end up with someone getting killed. I mean, I used to play basketball and was occasionally in fear of some knucklehead pulling that off. And I was in a softball game once where a guy didn't like the call, and he ran to his car to get a 45. And everyone scattered, and it was like...
Right. But, you know, that was far between. I mean, today, you have the daggone lunatic fringe, the Limbaugh and the Fox News. Every single thing that happens is because of Obama. There is something it's gone deep into the skin. I mean, I'm looking at the crime statistics now for 100, the rate of crime rate per 100,000 people. Per 100,000 people. Okay? And if you look at Buffalo, New York now, let's just take Buffalo, New York. 504 people. Okay? No, I'm sorry, read that wrong. Buffalo, what did I miss that, Buffalo? I was wrong there. New York. Oh, yeah, Buffalo, you're right. I was correct. They have an 18.3% murder rate in Buffalo, New York, with 200,000 people. Now, if you go into New York City, let's just take New York City. Everybody's afraid to go to New York because you'll get mugged. You'll get killed in New York City, right? Right. Well, New York City has 8,300,000 people. That the crime rate is 5.1%. So why isn't this happening in New York City?
Well, they went after it during starting with the mayor, even before Bloomberg, Michael.
Yeah.
But I want to speak to your question about why the murders are happening on the South Side. It's very clear. There's extreme amount of poverty, hopelessness, and these are areas that have a high concentration of minorities, whether Hispanic or African American or folks that are white folks that are poor, that are ethnic, and they're crunched into these places where they have no hope and no money. And what they do have is a high preponderance of street gangs and availability to weaponry. And so when you mix all that volatility together, you are going to get these kind of outcomes, not just in America. There are places around the world that have the same problem. And the one common denominator is the availability of guns.
Yeah.
Right.
If you take the guns out of there, you're not going to have that kind of violence. That's
yeah.
Randy
one
is
thing
absolutely
you can't
right.
anywhere in the world.
Well,
yeah, Randy is absolutely right.
If you take away the poverty.
He's absolutely right about the economic demographics of South Chicago. If most of the articles that you read, you'll find that's a very low impoverished area, as well as some parts of west side of Chicago. The southern parts of Chicago, it's just the natives there are indigenously poor. Low economic stature, no jobs in those areas. People have been saying for, you know, ironically, the University of Chicago is in the south side of Chicago, but they've went out and hired private police. Okay, and so the communities that are close to the University of Chicago—to the University of Chicago—are kind of like saved to an extent because of the private policing that is there. But it's like, you know, they were interviewing people like two blocks away. You might have multiple homicides within a week's time, and then just two blocks down the street where the University of Chicago is, they never. I mean, these people walk around, you know, without fear, you know, without anything happening. You know, so, you know, it's just a matter of resources, you know, the availability of resources. I mean, I don't know why the city hasn't tried to develop the south part of Chicago, to try to implement some type of either adult educational programs to get people back in school. I don't know whether it's an immigration problem or what the situation is. But, you know, like Michael, I mean, like Randy pointed out, it's just heavily concentrated with either African-American or Latino, and it is, you know, traditionally poor. You know, and that's why you have the violence. And like he said, the only viable thing out there for a lot of these young people is to join a gang. You know, that's their families. You know, and the red availability of firepower, like he said, like he, you know, just said, you know, just exacerbates the situation.
I agree 100% with that, because the problem is, and not talking about the guns, the problem, you know, in America is guns. That's why we have five times the murder rate of any industrialized nation on Earth. But beyond that, the problem with this, and your point is so concentrated, is exactly the poverty and the lack of resources. Lack of resources was a fantastic term, because that is what is missing in these neighborhoods. You know, when you go in and you strip out everything, and the Republicans are great at this, but when you defund all the societal investment so that there aren't libraries, there aren't schools, there's not, you know, child care centers, there's not things like this, you have nothing left. You have abandoned buildings and maybe a liquor store. And there's no hope. There's no chance for these people. And not to sound quaint or silly about it, but they should go in and put a library on every corner, or they should have a, you know, library bookmobile driving down the street or something, and give these people something to do and a chance to better their lives. They just need resources. They need investment. And that would solve all of this, because when people have something to do and they have something to reach for, they're not reaching for a gun. They're just trying to better their life and build a life.
Well, let me ask this question, and I'll ask this to the chairman first, then to Grace. In the areas, and I know you've been all across the state with the chairman, in those areas that you come to that are poor, most of them don't have representation. Is that true? Randy? Oh, we lost him. Oh, that's why he's not in. Grace, then I'll go to you. Grace?
Let me ask you. And yes, what you exactly you mean when you say they don't have representation, you mean that they're, the people who are supposed to represent them actually don't represent them?
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Because if they're elected as a city councilman, they're in the city, and they should be able to get funding to their area.
Right, and that's not happening, or if the funding does come in, it goes to some project or some place that actually does not benefit the vast majority of the constituency. Yeah, that does.
It happens
a lot, mostly because, I can't give a pat answer to that, okay? It's really difficult to do so. You know, I almost have to go back historically and look at each individual county or district or area and see, you know, really what it's made of. In many of these downtrodden areas, the person that gets elected to be the representative of that area ends up being a person from a family that is well known in that area. You know, outsiders don't get elected. They don't. You've got to be part of the neighborhood, a part of the area, and your family has to pretty much came over on a bag of Mayflower. So you'd have to been here for a while, because the people that do get elected, as I said, are members of the more prominent families in that particular area. Now, hopefully, you have a person who, because they grew up in the area and because they're a well-known family and because this family has for years and centuries and generations been the go-to people, the people they looked up to, hopefully that when you send that person to Raleigh or to Washington, D.C., they will bear in mind that the people that they're representing are their friends and neighbors.
Yeah,
and you know what happens when they go to Raleigh or to D.C. is, again, you know, it's power. Power corrupts.
So the problem then goes back to, you're saying that unless you're well known in that small little town that has a population of 2,000, unless you're well known, nothing's going to get done for that town unless you're well known.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you can be very well known and get elected and still nothing's going to happen. But the people of that particular town or particular area, that small town, feel that, well, he's still the best person, or she's still the best person to represent us. And, of course, they will find any excuse as to why he or she, the best person that they elected to represent them, is not bringing home the bacon, if you will. Well, you know, there's always an excuse. Maybe he is bringing home the bacon, but he ain't bringing it to them. He could be bringing it to himself.
Yeah, he's eating the bacon himself.
Yeah.
Well, so this is why people... Those people down there in this small little town, this fictitious town of 6,000, don't know what's going on.
No, and the congressman or the house, the representative lives in a big house, and you know, and he throws money around. He throws crumbs around. Rather like, and then I have to give the example of Robin Hayes. When Robin Hayes was 8th District congressman, he did give money to the black churches. He did find some money for the black communities. But what he found for them was a pittance compared to what he found for other areas. However, the black churches and the black population was really beholden to him because, wow, look, he brought us something. You know, Robin Hood gave us $40,000 last year. Well, maybe so, but he gave this other guy down the street, the white people, $4
million.
You know?
But you're
thankful for what you get, and again, it's keeping people downtrodden. The more you can keep them downtrodden, the more powerful a powerful man can be.
Right. So what you're saying is that even if you had somebody that's representing you, and you go to Raleigh, these people could still put you in the corner.
Yeah, you may not get representation. You know, once again, think about it this way. The reason why the right-wing nut jobs and the right-wing majority wants to defund education, and they want to defund, you know, health care, and they want to defund everything possible to do with the betterment of a society, is to keep people downtrodden. How are you going to, once they've seen Paris, you can't keep them down on the farm. So you got to keep them down on the farm.
That's right.
Let's keep them undernourished, undereducated, and in some cases uneducated. Let's have Project 100,000, which was started during the Vietnam era, where people, you came to change the criteria for admission into the Army so that people with IQs less than 65, in other words, they're functioning idiots, you know, can become drafted into the Army or can join the Army, and they become cannon fodder. Yeah, let's do that. And this is something that we as a population have to be aware of. This is what is happening to us. We are becoming, the dumbing down of America is a concerted, thoughtful process. They've done this on purpose. It is not an accident. The defunding of education and healthcare is not an accident. It is being done on purpose. We have to remember that. The only way we can fight, and the only way we can fight back, is to arm ourselves with knowledge. Knowledge is power. Arm ourselves with knowledge and spread that knowledge and refuse to allow them to keep us oppressed. So, you know, as Reverend Al Sharpton says, civil rights was one thing. We are still fighting the battle now. Now it's not just blacks and minorities, it's poor whites also. So we have, the battle is still going on now.
Well, David, what do you, what can you connect with that?
Well, the doc made a lot of good points, but, you know, just like, you know, where you have representation that's not really functional for the people, typically is due to the fact that, you know, low voter turnout, same thing the Democratic Party in North Carolina is experiencing right now, you know, difficulty trying to get folks out to the polls. But I'm not naive enough to just to put it all on politicians and those who are elected into a public office to make certain that poor children get the proper nourishment and the proper education and those who are unemployed get jobs and stuff. But when it comes to violence and things of that nature, you got to want to put down a gun. You got to want to not engage in violent crime. You know, I mean, that's got to be something that you want to do. In that area of Chicago, as well as not just Chicago, but places like Newark, New Jersey, Wilmington, Delaware, it's the same systemic issue where you have poor indigenous people, traditionally African-American or some other color ethnic group, who engage in violent crime. The socioeconomic dynamics are the same, low income, no job, poor education, or the lack of pursuing to get an education, you know. So I'm not just going to put it all on the politicians, because you know, you get what you get, you know. But at the same time, at the end of the day, you know, the people within the community gotta want to try to make a change, gotta want to stop the violence, gotta want to stop shooting and killing people. Perfect example, Michael, you and I talked about this last night. The 12-year-old kid that was shot and killed in Paterson, New Jersey, Genesis Raccoon. Hundreds of thousands of people marched and demonstrated on Town Hall in Paterson. I'm seeking justice for this little girl. They did eventually issue an arrest warrant for one of the suspects, but before he turned himself in, the citizens had already told the cops who the guy was. You know, and this is the kind of advocacy that I'm talking about. You know, you got to have people within the community who are going to say, it's time to stop the violence. We're going to get actively in charge. Take control. If we see something, we're going to say something. You know, you're not going to kill our kids. You're not going to shoot people in our community. If we see it, we're going to say something to the cops. And that's the kind of advocacy
kind of culture that you have to stop a lot of the street violence. And that's
not just
not New York or Patterson or Chicago. That's anywhere in America.
Tommy?
Yes, sir.
Tommy, what's your view on that? I think both what Dr. Gray said and what David said makes sense. But the thing I don't understand is, what do you do to get them to stop the violence?
Well, you got to do two things for that immediate change. I said earlier, you need to get the police in there. They need to be on every corner, everywhere. They need to stop the violence. They need to de-arm, you know, get rid of the guns that are flooding our society. And because, you know, I'm sick of every time they, you know, slaughter another school full of kids that they say what we need is more guns. It infuriates me. But the key to keeping the violence down, I mean, you can go in there, just roll in with the police action and shut that neighborhood down and, you know, end violence overnight. That's one thing. But to end violence permanently, we've got to reinvest in society itself. And they've got to have the tools to succeed. So they need, you know, job centers. They need libraries. They need schools. They need daycare. They need all of that stuff. And we need to quit abandoning entire, you know, downtown areas and rural areas and everything else that we just don't like for 5 minutes, and we just pull out of it like it's some third world nation and we just leave them dying in the dirt. We need to quit that mentality and get back to building America up, not tearing it down. Because that's the root cause.
You know, it's just been in the papers about this guy, I know, the woman who left the child in the car because she had to go in for an interview. I mean, what's the old saying, desperate times, you do desperate measures, you do desperate times, or what's that saying, Dr. Grace? Desperate times show desperate means. Well, the thing is that sometimes we're in a place where we have desperate times now. And it's really a problem where we have to look at what we actually can do. Some people just, you know, they just don't have the means to do both. They can't work and they have a child.
Right.
Now, hey, we can always go back to the same thing. Hey, well, you should have thought of that before you had a child. But, you know,
right.
It's like over in Europe. When you were in the hospital, they took you to the hospital. They just didn't let you die in the bed.
Right.
They took you to the hospital and said, don't worry about it. All students are covered here.
And that's a compassionate society. Though. Yeah. That's what society is supposed to do, take care of its weak and sick members at the time. You know?
Mm-hmm. So what are we to do? What are we to do when we have a society that don't care whether you live or die? Damn, it's about me. It ain't about you. What do we do? What can we do? David?
Well, you know, I bet you money if you let all these people kill themselves off, there'd be some nice companies that could come in, buy up that land really cheap and gentrify that whole area and turn it into a big profit.
Well, I'm sure that's it. David, are you there? David?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here, Michael. I mean, it does appear that you know, we don't care. We don't care about human life. We don't care about the American people. We don't care about struggling families. There's a lot of things it seems that we don't care about. But it goes back to what Dr. Grayson and what Randy hinted on earlier. We're talking about representation. You know, those who should be held accountable, who represent the people. If you're a state senator or your city councilman, your alderman's not down City Hall beating and banging on the table, say, listen, the constituents in my district need jobs. You know, what can we do to secure some type of employment? Or X Y amount of kids in my district are uneducated or of foreign descent who are illegal immigrants. You know, what can we do? What programs are available to them? You know, if you don't have somebody down there on a grassroots level beating and banging on the table, down at City Hall who make the decisions, who allocate the public funding, okay, based on the budget, the annual budget that comes, you know, you're not going to have that. You know, and that's why it goes to grassroots, it goes to the parents,
it goes to the people within the community saying something. You know, not just sitting back and twiddling their thumb and just accepting, you know, what's going on. You know, you have to go beat the streets. I mean, march in front of town hall. I mean, have sit-ins. I mean, they've done it before. It's been done in the past. Go down to city hall, sit in. You know, do something.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
You know, like you just said, Michael, drastic situations calls for drastic measures. You know,
Absolutely. I mean,
you it's always something that you can do to grab attention to the plight of a community. You know, especially those that are indigenously poor. You know, poor health care, lack of education, or what have you. And then the other part of it now, unfortunately, in many states, especially in the southwestern portion of this country, you got the dynamic of all these illegal aliens being dropped off at the border, you know, without their parents. You know, so, I mean, that creates another issue. That's another issue in America. We need to address our immigration issue because you got so many kids, you got so many people here who are here illegally, you know, that are taking jobs under the table. It creates a problem. That's part of the main, that's the main part of the, you know, the deprivation in terms of lack of employment. You know, if you got companies that are out here hiring guys under the table, paying them $3-4 an hour, a dollar under the table, you know, versus having to pay $8 or $9 minimum wage or $10, whatever it is in your state, you know what I mean? I mean, that's you're taking away jobs right there. So, you know, we got a number of issues, you know, and I think that, you know, Thomas really spelled it out. You know, it's like the, you know, we're really tearing down the country. You know, we're really tearing down America
from our
infrastructure. To our everything socially that the people have relied upon the government to take care of for us, you know, we're going down the tubes, man. Quick, fast, and hurry.
Well, I think you two guys need to run for office. That's what I think. And I want to change up things for a minute here. We have another caller in, but I'd like to introduce her this way. Just listen.
I got it.
I want to introduce, can you please introduce everybody and tell us your name?
Yes, I'm Tahira Scales.
Now say that again.
My name is can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, my name is Tahira Scales.
And Tahira, tell us something about you and what your bring into the table here for us to hear.
Well, I am the creator of Tahiru Raw Jewels. I am a jewelry maker here in Charlotte. And my jewelry is based on my African heritage and history. So I take all of my inspiration from the African culture.
And as I'm looking at some of this, it's really, I mean, unbelievably fantastic.
Thank you
I
very much.
I see some
much.
Of this, which is really beautiful.
Thank you.
Where did you get this inspiration from for doing this?
Well, I've always been somewhat artistic anyway. I'm also a hairstylist. I've been a licensed hairstylist for about 12 years now. So the creativity has always been there.
Thank goodness.
An uncle.
go ahead. Go ahead. I'll talk about that later. Go ahead.
Well, I had an uncle that was a barber, and my mother and aunt, they went to cosmetology school as well. My father, he is an artist. He loves to draw and he loves to cook. So it's in me to do artistic things. So I love to create jewelry and being able to represent my African heritage through my jewelry is just a great platform for me.
Mm-hmm. I see you have various sorts of styles. And I see one of these, were you wearing one of these? I think, what's the one I'm looking at right now? When I met you before, I think you were.
I think I was. I did have one, an unk piece. I had one, a silver unk with African trade beads.
It wasn't all black, was it? The one,
no,
I think, yeah, okay. And now, because I'm looking at some of them now, and I'm looking at this one I'm looking at has the cross on the end of it.
Uh-huh.
That's a necklace.
Yes, the ankh.
That's a necklace, yes. Right?
Yes, okay. It is.
And that's what they call the ankh, right?
That is the ankh. That is the ancient Egyptian symbol for life.
Mm-hmm. Very beautiful. Now, the colors I can see are... I'm looking at one that I can't even describe what the symbol is that's hanging off of it, but it's
that, you, looking at the brass pendant.
Is this a choker?
You're probably looking at the brass pendant necklace with the West African symbol from the Akin.
Oh, okay.
The African
tribe.
Yes.
Because I knew that, but I didn't know where I knew it from. Yes.
I try to find different pieces. I don't like doing duplicates of pieces because I think that when you're wearing your jewelry, it should be unique and it should represent who you are. So,
absolutely. How you got into the point of how you got into doing this. Now, you mentioned your sister. What is your sister? Is she involved? Does she make this also?
Well, no, she doesn't make jewelry, but she did introduce me to, she gave me a jewelry-making kit. And I just started as a hobby making bracelets. And so it just spanned off from there, and I've been doing it ever since. It's been over a year now.
Okay. I'm looking at here, this is the... watermark it? What is that? What is that? I'm looking at something that has a symbol. It's green. Has green beads on it. Green and round green beads in sort of an oval shape. What is this that's hanging off of it? It's a symbol.
That's the African symbol, the West African symbol from the Akan tribe. Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's also
try
a necklace, right?
Yes, that's a necklace. I work with a lot of brass and wood, and I'm always looking for
brass.
A unique.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now the symbol is made out of what? A brass?
Yes, that is a brass piece.
Okay. And is there wood in this also?
That particular piece, no. That is just vintage beads that I found. I shop at specialty bead shops, and I'm always looking for different shapes and colors to use that I feel looks African or vintage. to have that old feel to it.
Okay, you know, how do you use, or what do you use to connect the beads with? What sort of?
But there's.
I don't know. You say string, not string. What is it? Is it catgut or
wire.
Something? What do you use?
You use
it?
Wire.
Wire. What kind of wire is that?
Mm-hmm. They have what they call beading wire.
Beading wire. Okay.
Uh huh. You just string your beads on there, and any pendant that you want on there, and then you fasten it with clasp, and it mm-hmm. holds everything together for you.
Now, how can people look at some of this and see this online? Can they go and look at this?
Definitely. I'm actually selling, I'm happy to report that my jewelry can now be seen and purchased at the Harvey B. Gantt Center uptown Charlotte.
At the where? What's the name?
The Harvey B. Gantt Museum Shop.
Oh, the Gantt Shop here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes.
Down in, okay, good. Okay,
yes,
very good.
And also, you can go to Live It, Love It, Do It, BigCartel.com and place an order.
You say that one more time? What? Say that again one more time?
Can purchase and view. It's Live It. L-I-V-E. L-I-V-E.
Right.
Live It. Love
It.
Do It.
Do It.
Uh-huh. Dot Big Cartel. And that's BigCartel.com.
Okay, that's a long .com.
Yes. You can also go to my Instagram page at Tahira Rodules.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so those people here in Charlotte can go right down to the Harvey B. Gantt Center at the store, and they can look at some of these items. And are they in the astronomical range or the moderate range that people can purchase?
I try to keep everything affordable. So, they're in the moderate range. Some pieces may be as low as 20, and it may go up to 65, 70. It just depends on the material that I'm using and the amount of time that it took to put the piece together.
Right.
But I want everything to be affordable for everyone.
Well, I enjoyed just give us that long email address again. So people can write it down and be who don't live in the Charlotte area but live outside of the Charlotte area. Okay, what is it?
Okay, again, that is Live It, Love It, Do It dot bigcartel.com. And you can also go to my Instagram jewelry page, and that is Tahiru Ra Jewels, and that's T-A-H-E-R-U. R-A-H, Jewels, J-E-W-E-L-S.
Well, if you don't mind, and I have been doing it, I just call you T. So that's it.
anybody
calls me T, that's me. Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. That is fine with me. T is fine.
And my daughter loves her hair.
Well,
she
wonderful. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy it. That's my specialty, cutting and color. So,
my daughter loves it. As she needs it for a long time, and me, I can say the same thing to me too. You sort of rescued me. So we have to. I guess I'll see you in about another 3 weeks or so.
About 3 weeks.
Well, my
hair.
About 3 weeks. So anyway, I just love the time that I had to talk to you, and you need to get you on here. Your sister on.
Yes,
you
please do.
On.
She has, she has a wonderful blog at Live It, Love It, Do It. She's on Instagram as well. You can contact her, Tia Gets Life, on Instagram, or go directly to the Live It, Love It, Do It page if you have a artist that wants to be featured on the blog. Just contact them through Gmail. info.liveitloveitdoit@gmail.com.
Well, we're going to be having a lot. We got Blue Magic coming to town September the 6th, at the Little Theater here in Charlotte. So we're going to make sure that we put that on the blog. And I think we have done a I really like these pieces. I got to see some
in person.
And,
I'm always creating new things, so you never see the same thing twice.
That's very good. That's very good. So I just want to thank you for phoning in. And now, you don't recognize this theme, do you, that was playing? Did you recognize it?
Oh, I'm sorry?
Thomas, did you did you recognize that theme?
I don't recognize themes, Mike. I'm much too much of a thinker. Don't have time for that. No, I didn't. What's that?
Well, I don't think. Well, let's just listen to a few more bars of it. I just love this theme. Just listen. Now I know you probably know the movie, but you don't know the thing. Now the name of the thing is called Deborah's Thing, and I love this thing, and it's from a movie, Thomas. I know you know because we talked about it. Once upon a time in America.
Friday the 13th.
No. Once upon a time in America.
But
Al Pacino and Woods about the gangsters. So
I just love
this thing. But I thought it would go good with the introduction of slowing us down for where we were to our next transition, which was tea.
Yeah.
So anyway,
well, it was very pretty. just don't mention the gangster part. You know that.
That's right.
That doesn't help her very much.
Rizzo, this is very serene. So anytime you come on tea, this is going to be your theme. All right. So
we need to take her up to Chicago to give that city some love.
That's what it is. That's the whole story. So
I
want to thank you. You like Chicago? Well, you got to get down here and settle that South Side. That South Side is got to be done with. Something's got to be done with it. But anyway, thank you for coming on. And we need to have your sister. Tell your sister next week.
Next week? Okay, I sure will.
Same time, okay?
Same time, I will. Thank you very much for having me.
All right, thank you very much. And
thank
I
you.
Will see you in 3 weeks if I don't see you sooner. Okay.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so I knew no one would get that thing. But I just love that thing. It's so serene. And, I mean, it's just, and it was such a great transition to get us to where we're at, what we were talking about, all these murders in Chicago. Oh, God. We had to slow down.
After all that, we needed some peace.
Well, yeah. Now, hey, what about the, where am I at here? This issue. Oh, yeah. Let me cut her off here. What about, we need to talk about this. Let me go back to this. We need to go back into something funny. And here's the thing.
No.
Who's back again? Just listen.
So if an abortion could be considered in a case of, say, a tubal pregnancy or something like that, what about in the case of rape? Should it be legal or not?
Well, you know, people always want to try and make that as one of those things. Well, how do you slice this particularly tough sort of ethical question? It seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something. You know, I think there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be in the rapist and not attacking the child.
Okay, let's go to the economy. I mean, obviously.
Now.
Shut that whole thing down, Mike.
Can you believe this guy is back? Can you believe this
Mr.
back?
Legitimate Rape.
Mr.
Well,
Legitimate Rape.
These fools can't stay away, man.
I mean, what is the story with these people? Why can't they stay away? What is the story with these people? They can't help themselves.
They're freaks.
Todd Akins, who ran for the House and got beat to hell.
Like a drum.
Now wants to run again for the same seat. And nobody is in the Republican Party is backing him. But they're not saying, we are not going to give you any money. They're not backing him. They all want their hands off.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely outrageous. It's completely outrageous.
It's the same with all these guys. You got Man Love, what was it, Santorum or whatever. You know, you got all these people. They're just Man Dog. What do we say? Something like that. Man Dog Love. You know, these people are just the nuts. But you can't keep them away because all they know is attention and getting their hand on some of the money or something. I don't know what the deal is, but I don't understand a party that would even allow these people in to begin with. So that's all on the Republicans. They keep running people like this. They keep getting more extreme, it seems like.
But why? Why?
Yeah, I've been asking that for years, Mike.
I mean,
like mutants.
What's the satisfaction? What's the satisfaction to do this constantly? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-mm.
Doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, it's so wrong and derogatory and dismissive and all, but sometimes these type of people have no conception of what's, you know, right or wrong or whatever. They just are, whatever they say and do is the way. And you should just get the heck out of their way because they're always right and they always know best. And it's
well,
a kind of frightful thing.
Here's the thing. That's what he said almost 2 years ago. Here's what he's saying now.
Legitimate rape. Do you know anybody that thinks rape is legitimate? That legitimate rape means legitimate case of rape or legitimate case of rape. Think rape is
so why do you use the term?
Well, because of the fact that it's an abbreviation, as I said, legitimate rape means legitimate case of rape. If I had been, I should have said legitimate case of rape. He says, I've been raped, they investigate that. So legitimate case of rape, that's what they call it. But they use the word just legitimate rape. So rape is legitimate. I mean, that doesn't even add up. It was a legitimate rape comment. Who claimed under oath that Bill Clinton raped her, Hillary Clinton. Turns out, she's representing a guy who's a rapist. She knows he's a rapist. He raped a 12-year-old girl. She uses her influence. Should the child conceived in rape have the same right to life as a child conceived in love? That's the question. I'll say it again. Should a child conceived in rape, never said that a woman can't get pregnant who's raped. I never said that. A child conceived in rape.
Now, here's a guy in a 10 this was only like a minute and 11 seconds, but in a 10-minute interview with the interviewer, Todd Akins mentioned rape 21 times. He's got to do it or
what,
something. I mean, he is.
Yeah, you know, what's on his mind, right? Wow.
Well, it says here, the former Republican, Todd Akins of Missouri, who was the nominee for the Senate, I said representative, but it was actually the Senate, was completely derailed by his comments on legitimate rape. defends it. He said the Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill trounced Todd Akins by more than 15 points on her way to reelection in 2012. Akins struggled after saying in an interview that women's bodies could naturally prevent pregnancies in the case of legitimate rape. Okay? So he has a book out now. He's touring with a book, promoting his book, Firing Back, which explains he was actually correct when he said women's bodies prevent pregnancies in case of rape. Can you mention this?
Wow.
I mean, this is the moronic. This is where we're at. People don't care anymore. They will say anything that's in their mind. Anything that's mind.
Like, it's just... Again, no, and what is in his mind, you know, 28 times is rape, you know. It's, again, he's right no matter what. Everybody else is wrong. It's, you know, I remember a president that, even though he couldn't say it correctly, tried to say my way or the highway. So, you know, you get these people who, no matter what, despite any evidence, despite, you know, facts, they don't care. It's just what they believe. Only what they believe. You know, they have faith in themselves, and that's all that matters, you know.
I
personally don't want the United States Senator anywhere to be just Mr. Rape. I could do without that. That's my personal belief.
Well, we did not get to a lot of the stuff that we were talking about the four-winged dinosaur that we found. And
that's fantastic.
That we found, but the...
That's so cool.
We didn't get to the shellings in Gaza by the Israelis and the shellings in Israel by the Palestinians, Hamas, and we didn't get to the plane crashing that you're going to believe that people have already said that Obama was instrumental in shooting down that plane in Ukraine. They've already said it.
Yeah, you know they will.
So when we're at full scale war in the next 2 weeks in Ukraine, then we'll come back and we'll talk about that more, and we'll see how many missiles Israel is going to fire over into the Gaza. Well,
they want war. They want war, Mike. They're going to send over a whole division of those Chicago boys. Show them what a little South Side feels like.
That's what we need to do. I want everybody to have a good weekend. Thomas, I hope your lights come back on. Are they on yet?
They are on.
They are on. Okay, good.
Power has returned. It's amazing.
Okay, what about your computer? Is that back up and running? Are you still working on that?
I don't know. I haven't gone and tried it yet.
Okay. Everybody have a good weekend.
You too, sir.
And let's keep our fingers crossed that we can settle this Gaza right away, this Gaza and Israeli conflict. Okay, everybody, have a good weekend. That's it. We're gone.
Peace.